Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. The live web stream will begin in 15 seconds.
McDonald's has introduced new premium espresso-based specialty coffee drinks, including creamy lattes, frothy cappuccinos, rich mochas, even iced lattes and iced mochas, all custom-made to order. McDonald's, I'm loving it.
Award-winning night call, the Riff's Phone-In Talk Show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the broadcast. Another Sunday in Detroit, WRIF. Welcome to everyone listening on the radio and also to everyone listening on the internet, all across the country and all across the world. But you know, you might not be able to do this forever. There is a real threat to internet radio. In fact, it says on my website, Save Internet Radio. If you enjoy listening to Night Call and the Peter Werby Show, which follows it on the internet, you better think about getting involved, because they are talking about imposing royalties that could drive. And this, let me introduce my co-conspirator, my unindicted co-conspirator so far, Jalene Jordan. Hi, Jalene.
Hi, Peter.
Did you know this is going on?
Happy Earth Day.
It's not my birthday.
Happy birthday.
Okay.
I did not know this was going on.
Now,
I check your website every day.
The webmaster of radiopower.org turned me on to this. And I was telling her, I didn't know what the hell she was talking about. I'm thinking, you know, all this stuff, as you know, with MySpace and websites, it drives me nuts.
Yes.
All I want to do is turn on the mic.
All you want to do is take a walk in the park.
Yeah, or take a walk on the wild side.
Sorry.
Yeah,
We had to do it.
But there's a real threat to it. And I wrote, Shelby, that this time we have some powerful elite allies. Because, for instance, our parent company, Greater Media Inc., is really disturbed about the fact that we might not be able to have WRIF streaming anymore. It could just go away under pressure from, you know, these other big corporate.
Yeah, I was wondering who's there.
Come on, don't make me look dumber than I am.
Well, whoever they are.
Go to my website. In fact, let's see. Where can we? If you go to the website, it is. I'll tell you the website to go to if it'll ever come up. Oh, yeah. SaveNetRadio.org. SaveNetRadio.org.
Excellent.
And you go to my website. In fact, if you wanted to start there, there's lots of things I'd like you to see. Peter Werby. W-E-R-B-E. Oh, yeah, that's nice. SaveNetRadio.org could not be found.
We'll figure it out.
That was a weird laugh, wasn't it?
It's kind of
yours
sinister.
Too. Yeah. Well, let me try it one more time. You know, just sometimes it happens.
Yeah. Definitely.
I linked it right off of their site. Anyway, that
just
is.
Just think, how many people listen to the radio?
Millions and millions. All our friends across the world and all that.
Yeah.
Well, folks, it keeps telling me that we can't. Am I spelling SaveNetRadio.org? Could not be found. Well, that's a great way to start the show. Anyway, folks, wait a little bit before you click on that.
Straightened out.
Yeah, but definitely go to my site, Peter Werby, WERBE.com. You can email us at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Also, myspace.com/nightcalldetroit. myspace.com/nightcalldetroit. Well, geez, just another wonderful week on planet Earth, right? And there's such horrible and serious things to talk about. At least I want to talk about a couple of things that that I went to this week that struck me so incredibly. Last night, I heard the master of the sitar, Ravi Shankar, and when I asked a couple of younger people around the station whether they knew who he was, and they said no, but he was George Harrison's sitar player. In fact, you know, I meant to, just in case people are sitar, what the hell is that? That thing that kind of goes, no, that's not a good imitation. You know, some of the Beatles stuff.
It's hard to imitate it, but it is a beautiful instrument.
Yeah. And they played, they being Ravi Shankar and his daughter, who not Nora Jones. Nora Jones is his daughter as well. But
right.
And sad to say, even though I was at the concert, I can't remember his other daughter's name. And he's 87 years old.
Is he really?
Yeah. And his master, his teacher, his guru, lived to be over 100. But Ravi Shankar came, he was led onto the stage at Orchestra Hall in Detroit by some of the other people that played in the little group, with played tablas and tambura, the other instruments that make up these Indian groups. And I said, boy, man, he just looks ancient and shaky and very, very weak. And instead of sitting cross-legged, he had to actually sit on a table. It was very sad. And then he said that he'd been very sick, that he had double pneumonia, he'd almost died. And then he began playing, and it was amazing. It was amazing. The more he played, the stronger he became.
He went to another place.
He did. Yeah. Yeah. I was talking to Mark Pasman, and he was saying, man, yeah, he just got the adrenaline rush of playing. And he said all the all the memory of every note he'd ever played just came, streaming forth out of his consciousness and subconsciousness.
I bet that was beautiful.
Yeah. So Ravi Shankar, in a sense, really sort of an icon of the 60s, both of the music and sort of that whole hippie enjoyment of things Indian, including Indian food. I'm like, that Pavlov's dog, that whenever I hear Indian music, I start to salivate. And also another icon of the 60s, but certainly into the 21st century, Ralph Nader, who I both saw a documentary about him and called An Unreasonable Man. And then he appeared in person at the Detroit Film Theater, which is in the Detroit Institute of Arts. And it was interesting because this wasn't just complimentary of Ralph.
Yeah.
And there were obviously people there that still hold him responsible for the victory of George W. Bush in 2000. In other words, that if the argument is that if Nader hadn't gotten 80,000 votes in Florida, that Gore would have won properly. Well, he did win. I mean, in the movie, although it really refuted the sort of, if you will, mathematically almost, that it was Nader's fault, it never mentioned the fact that Bush's father's friends handed his son the election. It never talked about the suppression of African-American votes. It never talked about that there was never a full recount, and it would have been pretty clear that Bush would have lost. And Bush lost the popular election by 10 million votes. I mean, we used to call him the loser on our national show.
Yes.
Because the guy came in second. George W. Bush came in second. I mean, the majority of people wanted Al Gore to be the president in 2000. And instead, we really got the loser.
So was there a question-answer session with Ralph? And what was his answer to these people?
Well, he answered in the film. He answered in the film.
Okay.
And he was so gentle with everyone. A number of people came up and asked him questions, someone about his criticism of Israel over the invasion of Lebanon last year. And it was obviously somebody very passionate and had great sympathy for Israel and Zionism. Mm-hmm. And Ralph Nader, who's of Lebanese ancestry, he was just everything he spoke about, he was kind. And some woman at the end just started making this speech denouncing the patriarchy and going on. And she was just speechifying. And people started yelling at her and saying, sit down. They wanted you to say.
I mean, oh, no, that she had to do that,
yeah.
Right?
And you know what he said? He said, it's okay. He said, people like her rarely get a chance to speak. It's not going to hurt. It's not hurting any of us.
Oh, you know, that is an inspiration, actually.
He really was good. April 28th, which is next Saturday, is an Impeach Bush Day.
And, okay.
And you can go. This will work. A28.org. People are doing things all over the country, hundreds of cities, because certainly the Democrats have taken it off the table. And so this is demanding that it be put back on the table. The U.S. Supreme Court, as I write on my website, stacked with crazed right-wing men appointed by Bushko, hands the compulsory pregnancy movement a victory.
Yeah, and, you know, this just kind of snuck by us this week.
Yeah.
Because there were big
Something
news
else. Yeah.
stories going on. But this one, you know, I can barely even speak about what happened in the Supreme Court.
313-298-WRIF, by the way, is our phone number. 313-298-9743. And, well, maybe everyone's waiting for me and you to talk about what happened in West Virginia. Someone just wrote in, Kathy, I think it was, to say, maybe it's right up here, so I give her proper credit. A little later in the show, I'm going to be playing an interview with Greg Palast. And in talking about that, I don't know why I said that. I said Virginia instead of West Virginia. So thank you. The correction department is... You know,
it's open.
You know what? Get this. It says my email could not be found. So maybe we're having problems here. So I would say that link I gave you before, which
was probably good.
What was it? SaveNetRadio.org. Yeah. Maybe. Ooh, wouldn't that be weird if this is all gone
by? Amazing. Bye-bye. Computers having problems.
Yeah.
It has made our lives so much easier in so many ways and so much not easier in other ways.
Writing. It's the only way it's done it.
You know, I've started to bring back the art of writing letters.
Oh, I can't.
Writing letters to my mother.
Really?
She loves it.
If I were sign my name, my hand starts to hurt.
Stop it.
No, this is. I think we're down. I don't think we're on the internet. Okay, we'll work that out. Well,
call the engineers.
The terrible occurrence in West Virginia, I think, has just been, emblazoned in all of our minds. I'm not even sure what more that I could say. Sheldon Drobny, who we should say, and what are they, full disclosure, who I have almost worked for any number of times. He writes, he says, if you want to get through the aftermath of the Virginia Tech massacre in a healthier way, don't watch the news for about a week. If you did not need an antidepressant before this event, you may have to start if you decide to listen to, watch, or read the news. He wrote this on April 17th. That's a few days ago. These vultures will do you in. Spend a week with your family and hug them every day to appreciate them. He's take a MSM holiday, a mainstream media holiday. Go to the movies or a museum. Do anything that interests you to divert your attention from the toxic doses of media poisoning that is about to follow. Well, this was right when it happened, wasn't it? The MSM will spend endless hours talking about the why did he do it or why did this happen routines that they always go through. And the answer, he says, is there is no answer or rational explanation for it. Given the state of our society, I would ask why this does not happen more often.
Oh, wow. Well put. And I agree. I had to turn it off. I've turned it off more and more all the time. But I got sucked in there for a while.
I know little about all the details. In fact, I went on the internet. They had the video of Cho, and I turned it on, and I would say that it was like he said, and I saw this face, and I turned it off.
Yeah, just makes you nauseous.
I don't want that in my brain for the rest of my life.
True.
And this goes on and on and on. This is from... a few days ago, Kalamazoo, that's in Michigan, folks, if you're listening elsewhere. Kalamazoo Public Safety Department officials said they are investigating a triple homicide and suicide where four people, including two young boys, were found shot to death on Tuesday inside a home near Western Michigan University. My fear is that increasingly this is how people act out their rage.
their range, whether they have been fired or whatever.
Which happened down in NASA in Houston.
Yeah, and it happened maybe 5 miles from my house last week.
In Troy, Michigan?
Yeah, that's right. So that is a frightening prospect.
81 people a day die from gunfire. In 2004, the last year they have statistics for, 29,569. And, you know, a big industry is what they call these in memory of T-shirts. You ever see those?
Oh, well, I've seen bumper stickers on cars.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I guess they haven't pinned.
When I lived in Miami, there were a lot of
That's
them.
A real center of it. I can't think all of a sudden. What's the area in the high crime area in Miami?
Oh, would it be Hialeah?
Yeah, well, that's one of them.
Yeah.
Well, in any event.
Liberty City,
yeah. They have, I was just reading about this manufacturer who people come in there and they say, here's the young man or the young woman that died, and they got T-shirts. But anyway, so there was this killing. I was saying, 30,000 in 2004 injured, 65,000, 176 a day. So that's about 1 million people a decade.
From guns. And you own guns.
I do.
Think it's important that you say that.
Yeah.
No guns in my house, never will be.
Okay.
You know what? And if you want to hunt and own guns.
I don't hunt.
But I'm saying, to the listeners.
Yeah.
Great.
Keep them in your gun bags because there's lots of accidents.
Teach your kids the right thing.
Yeah, these aren't murders, by the way, folks. This isn't all people that are. In fact, I don't have
accidents.
Oh, yeah, accidents. Some are legal homicides, like police shooting people to death. This is all
suicides.
Included. Oh, yeah, a lot of suicides.
Yeah.
And people say, well, they'd find some other way. This is no argument for anything, but I'll tell you one thing. After the portrayal, the accurate portrayal, of course, of Cho, the shooter. If you're a freak, or a geek, or a loser, or a loner, or a shy guy, if you're just quiet, if you're a weirdo, an oddball, a misfit, just kind of odd, or fearful, suddenly you're going to be a citizen under suspicion.
And, adding to the list.
Yeah. And, I say all those words. Those are maybe the words that that so many of these people, like the Columbine shooters and all that felt that, they
outsiders.
Were on the outsiders. And in the real human-loving community, there aren't freaks and geeks and losers.
You know, in the city that I live in Royal Oak, Michigan, up and down Main Street, there's all these goth kids and kids with the Mohawks, and I celebrate it. I think it's wonderful, and I just fear that someday, the kids in Columbine, they were wearing black and things like that, that someday that even your own form of self-expression will be judged because of things like this.
Well, you are, like I say, that all of a sudden, people that don't express themselves, and there's so many depressed people in this society. I mean, there's an epidemic of depression, particularly of male depression.
Really?
Yeah. It even made the front page of Newsweek a few weeks ago.
More men,
I didn't know that. Which means it's official. One of the things that happens, and we'll hear about this at 1 a.m. with Greg Palast, he has a book out called Armed Madhouse. Armed Madhouse. And this is not about guns and what have you. It's the nature of America and the world under Bush. And this is turning into a madhouse. I mean, that's what Shelley Drobny means when he says that given way things are, I mean, he's surprised that this doesn't happen more frequently. But Greg Palast talks about something called an iron pipeline, because the southern states have much, much more lax rules about
getting guns.
Yes. So that all of these companies like Glock and Walther and the rest of them, they ship a tremendously more amount of guns into these states than could possibly be consumed by the residents of that state, which then, and that's what the police call the iron pipeline. So these guns that are shipped to Alabama wind up in Chicago, our city, Detroit, New York, Los Angeles, because you can go down there and you can buy something for $400.
Legally.
Come back to New York and sell it to somebody illegally for $750, say. But one of the things, and I don't have the statistics here, but I remember that an extraordinarily high percentage of the illegal handguns confiscated by the police and the commission of felonies, including capital felonies, murders, were purchased legally in Virginia, but then wound up in the commission of a crime because they went from, they were purchased and people brought them up there.
Oh, wow.
The
interesting.
Most of us were just so shocked, so horrified. And it was hard in a way not to make some political points off it. I really tried to stay away from that and just, and I'm thinking, and in some ways I'd like to, but of course the right wing always, you know, what typifies conservatives and right wings is like absolute lack of compassion. And I don't know if I mentioned this before.
Start with John McCain, or
yeah, John McCain for sure. But you know, let me tell you, there's you know, Blade Runner, the movie.
I do know the movie.
Yeah, it came from the wonderful writer whose name will come to me, and Philip K. Dick, who was this amazing science fiction writer. And the name of the book that Blade Runner came from was called "Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep?" And it was about, if you remember, that androids that they had created were indistinguishable from human beings, and yet the Blade Runners had to find these androids, and they could find out, and no one, unless you've seen it recently, remembers what the key was, that they would look in their eye with this thing, and the only thing that distinguished them from human beings were that they lacked the capacity for empathy. That's
wow.
What, in other words, Dick's...
sounds like the Terminators.
Well, yeah, Dick's... And this was written at a time of the Vietnam War, and what his point was that in order to be human, you have to empathize, you have to your heart has to go out with to people. And McCain and Rush Limbaugh and the Nuge, I mean, they are just angry.
They're not empathizing.
No, they're not empathizing at all.
I get your point.
Yeah. Here, Republican presidential candidate John McCain, he believes in no gun control at all. Sure, let's get everybody automatic weapons.
This guy has completely lost his mind, Peter.
He is. He is so history in terms of being the president. He says, I do believe in the constitutional right that everyone has in the Second Amendment to the Constitution to carry a weapon. Doesn't say that at all, but whatever. Obviously, we have to keep guns in the hands of law-abiding citizens. John, that's a problem. Yeah, Cho was not a law-abiding citizen.
That's right.
All the people that kill people, by definition, aren't law-abiding citizens.
And he had been checked out for his mental issues, right? So
yeah.
Anyone
Cho.
Who has gone...
Or McCain.
Cho. Well, McCain
needs
to.
Be. Yeah.
But Cho had some issues where he was in a creative writing class, and he was writing very disturbing things, so they sent him to be checked out by mental health professionals. You really are not supposed to sell a gun to someone
yeah.
who has recently been checked out by mental health professionals.
Well, you could go.
From what I understand.
You could go about it two ways, right? You could go about it two ways. One is that this may be a society that is too volatile, too crazed, too depressed, too angry for us to be permitted to have weaponry. Because one of the, you know, when people make the argument to say that, guns don't kill people, people kill people. Well, I mean, it's then the kind of the response is, it's people with guns that kill people. But they often make the argument, and in some European countries like Switzerland, almost every home of an able-bodied man is a member of the militia and has an automatic weapon in their house. And there's like next to no murders at all.
Yeah,
so,
how do you explain that?
Yeah, well, it might be that we are just some crazy freaks.
Yeah, I was having this exact same conversation with a friend the other day about Canada and Fahrenheit 9/11 and Michael Moore. And, you know, he went to this lady's house. Oh, we leave our doors unlocked. And why are there so many guns there but so fewer murders?
The rate, I heard Tom Hartman, our colleague, does National Network show, talking about the statistics, even allowing for the population differences in terms of ratio. And it's like, we're always talking about, are we number one? Well, we're certainly number one in all of that. But I think maybe taking the cake for lack of compassion, lack of capacity to empathize, on April 19th, and when did this happen? On the 17th, was it? Let me see. It's got to be... 22nd, 15th, 16th. It happened on the 16th. So on the 19th, here's Limbaugh. If this Virginia Tech shooter had an ideology, what do you think it was? This guy had to be a liberal. This is Rush Limbaugh.
Oh, this is new to me.
Saying that Cho, the shooter, the massacre man, the guy that methodically went around and pumped 100 shots into about 30-something people, was a liberal. He had to be a liberal. Well, why? Because here's Limbaugh again. You start railing against the rich and all this other. This guy's a liberal. He was turned into a liberal somewhere along the line, so it's a liberal that committed this act. He says, liberals are the people sponsoring lies and distortion for the purpose of dividing this country and creating hatred. These are the people that invented this kind of tactic. I don't even know.
Still my heart.
Yeah. Well, if
this guy is insane.
Well, what he had a true fascistic Cho did, and from what I read, this denunciation of the class above him is
of rich kids.
Well, yeah, is typical actually fascist ideology. This resentment, sort of lower middle class resentment. This you can go, Nazi Germany, fascist Spain, fascist Italy, and they have both this hatred for the wealthy and also this hatred for the classes below them and for minorities and what have you. But look at, I saw, how many times we've seen this photograph. Usually people say that liberals are kind of, weak and all that. This is a man turned into a monster.
Absolutely.
And this is the kind of killing machine that typifies this conservative turned fascist. And remember, everywhere along the line in these fascist countries in Europe in the 20th century, the conservatives backed the fascist coming to power. There is never the slightest, they all thought that was just fine. Neil Bortz, who fortunately we are not cursed with in the city of Detroit.
He's a broadcaster, for those who don't know.
He's a right-wing talk show host. And he said on April 18th, the bodies are not even buried, not a one of them. And he says, how far have we advanced to the wussification of America? He says, how the hell do 25 students allow themselves to be lined up against the wall in a classroom and picked off one by one? How does that happen when they could have rushed the gunman, the shooter, and most of them would have survived? I mean, I don't know. I mean,
like he was in the room.
Yeah, yeah. Can you imagine? Take a look. Well, let me put it this way. I don't want to urge you to do it again. Look at Cho again. Look at his face. Think about him, shooting people. Think of this blood and this carnage. And, yeah, maybe that is the first thing that occurs to us. In prisons, for instance, the prisoners at any time could overcome the guards. That's...
And they do at times.
Rarely. That's not what keeps
the
control.
Well, in the movies, anyway.
but here you would think, this is a matter of life and death. I don't know. Who knows what happened? But inappropriate thing to say.
Especially when I've read a little more into it, and the students were running to the back, hiding behind desks in the corner, in the back of the room. They were attempting to get away from this guy and save their lives.
Yeah. And would it have been better for some of them to rush him? Yes, it would. Now, the biggest nut of all, Ted Nugent, it was because of his antics on stage, and some of you, probably most of you know, but some of you may not know, is a rock and roll guitarist from Detroit, who's called the Motor City Madman for both his style of guitar playing, which is excellent, sort of a 70s thing, but still, he's still out there
still
playing.
Still packs the house, man.
Still packs the house, yeah. He moved from the Detroit area, or at least
Jackson,
Michigan, down to Crawford, Texas.
Where G.W. Bush lives, for those of you who don't know that.
At a time when Bush's popularity was riding high.
What did he want to go? What is it? The hunting they do down there, the wild boar. Was that his next?
He's a wild boar.
Did he want to?
Oh, B-O-A-R, you mean? Yeah.
Did he want to live near Bush and hunt the wild boar? What I don't understand it.
But
he
anyway,
can stay there as far as I'm concerned.
Here's what he says: that we should just arm everyone. That if all those kids would have been armed, that never would have happened. Well, you know what? He's right. But here's why he's a moron. First off, if we would live in a society where there was a good chance that most of the men, or at least in a society like ours, or all of a good number, a good percentage of the people, all were strapping heat.
I mean, really?
He probably wouldn't have done that because he knew that he could carry this out. Cho, the shooter, knew that he could carry this out. He knew that no one would be armed. So the argument is then, if everybody was armed, then this wouldn't have happened.
That's right. I read this. It was a by Ted Nugent special to CNN.
Yeah.
Oh, gee, thank you. Thank you, Ted. So I wrote down at the bottom, so we need, this is what he is saying, we all need guns to stop those with guns.
Yeah.
Okay. Not making sense, not buying it, Tedley.
Well, there are some, I mean,
love you, rock and roll.
Well, is this just theoretical? Let's look at some current examples. Where are the few societies where everyone's armed? Baghdad? All of Iraq. There you go. Everyone's armed. And I'm sure some people don't mess with some people because the people are carrying like AK-47s. Although, on the other hand, we see what's happening.
Yeah, even I'd be armed in Baghdad.
Yeah. How about Rio de Janeiro in Brazil, the powerhouse economy of South America, where now the gangsters have massive shootouts with the police, with each side carrying automatic weapons. So
so we want that here.
There you go.
Great.
Or Caracas, where about half the men are armed and the murder rate is just skyrocketing. Yeah, so we want more people with knowing the history, the instability of such a large segment of the population.
True.
That arm more people. Well, that's good.
Hey, the Europeans are blaming Charlton Heston. Did you see that?
Good.
It was all over the European newspapers. They're blaming Charlton Heston.
Well,
I don't know why.
The Nuge is
very funny.
The Nuge is in, I think that's what he sees. He'll be president of the NRA.
He's next.
He's next.
He can't wait. He's salivating.
That's what happens when everyone's armed in Iraq today. Gunmen shot and killed 23 members of an ancient religious sect in northern Iraq on Sunday after stopping their bus and separating out followers of other faiths, while car bombings in the capital killed at least another 20 people.
You know, someone made this point the other day to me that you think about the 33 people, including Cho, who died in this massacre. That happens times two or three every single day in Iraq. But, you know, a lot of people, there's still a segment of the population that does not give one you-know-what about those people.
That goes back to the compassion and empathy quotient missing in conservatives. You know, my sister was just in England, my sister and her daughter. And on Monday or Tuesday, I think it was on Tuesday, they went into a, what do they call them? Just a, there's a word for it, a fish and chip shop. Maybe that's just what it is.
A pub.
Yeah, something like that. And the owner said, I'm so sorry what happened in your country.
Really?
And my sister said, what? You know, what now? No. She didn't even heard. And he told her. And she said the guy almost looked like on the point of tears.
Really?
Except the Americans, and I have to say, and I'm not saying all of us, I mean, if the shoe fits, wear it, but people in this country, we hear about these massacres, and what it does, it almost, for many people, kind of confirms our sense of the other. These people are crazy. They're killing each other, and we see these shots. I mean, how can we watch the nightly news and see this carnage on there and not have our hearts go out to those families in the same manner that we do for people in our
That's
in our country.
A great question.
Well, there is, you know, there is the sense. The more people are like us or we or any group, the more you identify. And the less they're like us, well, if they've been made totally into the other. Well.
Yeah, they're wild-eyed, crazy people, you know. I've always said that. And you know what? I'm going to make a confession.
What's that?
I cry every single day about what goes on over there in
Iraq.
Every single day, because I pay attention. If I could just get away from it for a while. But then again, they can't get away from it.
Now, being a guy, I steel myself against it.
Yeah.
Hey, give us a call. Peter Werby, Jalene Jordan. We're at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. We'll be right back.
This is WRIF.com.
Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and give us a call. I'm here with Jalene Jordan. We're talking about, as you can imagine, the shooting in West Virginia. Ignore me during the interviews at 1 a.m. where I say Virginia. I don't know where how I got into that. 313-298-WRIF. Just want to hit this one thing. A transgender student is running for prom king in Fresno High School. It's Cynthia Covarrubias. Covarrubias, I guess it is.
Covarrubias.
Covarrubias, yeah.
Beautiful name.
Yeah, and it's a young woman, about 16. She's running for king. She's, I would never have run for anything if I had to wear a dress. She considers herself transgender, although she has no plans to alter her herself, chemically or surgically. And let's see, gay youth advocates called it a landmark victory for campus gender expression. So they believe it's the first time in the U.S. that an openly transgender student has run for prom royalty. Leanna Reyes, 16, said Covarrubias had her vote. She says, it's not like the stereotype where the king has to be a jock and he's there with the cheerleaders anymore. We live in a generation where dudes are chicks and chicks are dudes.
Such an open-minded generation. Yeah. I think that's great.
Although some students criticized the decision. Eric Logan said, I like lesbians, but they shouldn't be allowed to run for king.
Oh, jeez. Of course they like lesbians. Do we have to hear that again?
All right.
Or the one, I am a lesbian. You know, I get that from a lot of guys.
Really?
I'm a lesbian, too. Yeah.
I'm not sure I want to go there.
I'll explain later.
Yeah. All right. We got to go back to the serious stuff, too. Your opinions, please. 313-298-WRIF. And let's go to JJ. He is in Shelby Township. Hi, JJ. You're on the air.
Hey, how's it going?
Going good.
Yeah, I just had something to say about that. What happened at the college in Virginia Tech? You would think after something like how the shootings happened in Cal and all the other schools, they would have tightened up on security. I think that's kind of BS that something like that, they let something like that happen and let all the students be exposed to something like that. You would think they'd step up the security and start cracking down on more suspicious people, especially with them barricading the doors so no one can get out.
Well, that's what's a problem. I don't know if you heard that list of people, but I mean, think about it. I'll just say it one more time. I wrote it down. Freaks, geeks, losers, loners, shy guys, people are just quiet, weirdos, oddballs, misfits, people are fearful, people that are depressed. I mean, when you add up the number of people that fit into those disparaging categories, we're talking about millions and millions of people, and because people are a little different, we should be able to still accept them into our communities. And I mean, most 99.9% don't act out the way this twisted character did. But there is a lesson there about tolerance, and just like that last story fit in there about this transgendered person, which probably to most people would be considered a freak. So, I mean, that person seemed to have a good sense of themselves, and it's not going to come back to school in any destructive way. Let me ask you, you're not in school now, are you, or are you?
Oh, I go to college, yeah.
Yeah. Does your school... Oh, if I may ask, where do you go?
I go to Macomb Community College, but I mean, it's not a university, but
No, I know. But is there any, to your knowledge, any security plan in operation?
You know, they do have security cameras, and they have a couple of people that do walk around the halls just to monitor people, you know?
Well, let me tell you this, JJ. I mean, I don't think I'm doing anyone a disservice by naming the school, but Cranbrook, which is a prep school, high school, kind of a ritzy one, although they have scholarship students there. Last, it was the same day. It was. I don't know if that's what triggered it. That had happened already. But there was code red came across, and the Cranbrook security procedure went into operation.
Wow.
And what that is, every door was locked from the inside of the classroom. Those were put in, specially. They were locked, and there's a deadbolt you can turn. The outside has to be opened by a key only. the teacher was responsible for determining sight lines from the windows and from the doors.
Ah, frightening.
Yeah, and these are, and including a friend of mine's 8-year-old son was one of the people that had to do this. You pull down the shades. You take you lock that door from the inside, and everyone goes to the spot in the room that is the least in the sight lines from the outside or the inside, and they huddle. They leave their seats and they huddle.
And what are these kids thinking?
And they are required to say absolutely nothing, and they cannot get out of that huddle until the door is unlocked from the outside with a key by a security officer. And if they hear something like, "It's all clear, is there anyone in there?" or "It's all clear, come on out," they don't come out. They can only come out if it's... So this is what's in... This is the kind of procedures that you're going to find everywhere. And there is going to be, just like we have a military-industrial complex, just like we have a prison-industrial complex, we do already have a security-industrial complex, but it's going to be even heightened. So look for that at your school,
Georgia. And look for more homeschooling, right?
That's awesome to hear that they're putting, you know, some kind of security enforcement like that.
Well,
you know, pretty much preventing something like this ever happening.
Well, you know what? It's sort of a double-edged sword. On one hand, you'd think, well, man, maybe if that would have been in a place in West Virginia, that wouldn't have occurred. But on the other hand, we just increasingly live our lives in fear, foreign terrorists and terrorists in our midst. And now we have to add to that those people among us that are these walking time bombs. Something's
it's
wrong.
So much that I just
ordered
a book about fear.
You did.
I'll get back to you on it.
Hey, you know, what? Do you remember what the name of it is?
I can't.
Because there was a psychologist that...
This is it.
That's the book.
This is
you
the
ordered
book.
It? You paid for it?
I did.
I have it sitting in my house.
Oh, lovely.
All right.
Well, now we have two.
All right. All right, let's go to Jeff. Jeff's in Ferndale. Jeff, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air with Peter and Jalene.
Hi, how are you doing?
Doing well.
I just thought I should comment on a couple erroneous comments. First of all, you had said that depression was more prevalent among males.
Yeah.
And actually, the studies show that it's more prevalent among females.
We can't argue about facts. It's one or the other.
There's a lot of studies.
Yeah, I'm sure if you looked it up again, you'd see females. It's not that important, except for I think it kind of relates to the point with the school. We don't really know exactly why depression is higher among females, but it's probably cultural. You see, with anorexia and bulimia and things, with this ideal feminine you see in media and the movies and everything.
The pressure to be skinny and beautiful, yes.
Right.
Wait, how about this, Jeff? What if we say that depression in American society among men and women are at an epidemic level?
Oh, I definitely agree
with
that.
All right.
And I think probably the main reason would be because of this kind of irrational fear that has crept in since probably the 60s with counterculture movement, and I think that's why.
What?
As you commented earlier with Rush Limbaugh.
Yeah.
I think what he was saying, he was one trying to make a little joke. I think.
That is so funny, 30, Rush.
32 people dead, and he's making it a joke.
Oh, you're killing me! Oh, no pun intended.
Yeah, go ahead.
Might not have that good of a sense of humor, but
hey,
we have excellent senses of humor, believe me. But when it comes to this guy, sorry.
Yeah. This guy is...
And don't hate me for sounding like a mean,
right.
You know, bee.
Okay.
I think he was just trying to say that liberal culture has kind of created this irrational fear, this sense of self-guilt and...
Wait a minute. If anything, what has instilled fear into the American people is the manipulation by the elite, sometimes of both parties and of all political persuasions, but the elites of this society that began with these irrational fears about nuclear war after World War II, which then transformed itself into a real threat. But so the whole economy was run on an absolutely non-existent nuclear threat from the Soviet Union up until the late 70s when they actually gained nuclear parity. And then, because all this is what drives the economy. This is what drives an economy that is based on war expenditures. And without this, without, I mean, and whoa, the Soviet Union went away. I guess we're going to have to collapse this huge war complex made up of all these industries and all that. But no, then they found terrorism, and then they found Saddam Hussein, and actually, once again, they're making it real. It really now is a threat. They've been successful, and now we in fact probably have screwed ourselves once again, so that we have to spend jillions of dollars on preparation for what? I don't know. I mean, fighting guys with barefoot with Kalashnikovs, you need a big military? I don't know.
Well, are you saying that 9/11 wasn't real? I'm not sure how it's not real.
Well, no, it's very real, but it certainly worked massively to the benefit of Bushko, who has manipulated the fear of another. It was manipulated politically to ensure that the Republicans get reelected and that we spend hundreds of billions of dollars and create massive bureaucracies that probably, the opposite occurs. In fact, given the Bush response to it, we are more at risk from terrorism now than before. In fact, if there would have been a realization by the Bush mob when they came into office, as they were warned over and over and over again, including right before it happened that Al-Qaeda threatened to strike inside the United States, September 11th never would have occurred. It is like Katrina, Bush, the 9/11 is at the feet of administrators who were so off target that they essentially allowed 9/11 to occur.
And even Bush, I think last year, in the later portion of the year, admitted that Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with 9/11. Iraq
they
had nothing to do.
They never said he did have anything to do with 9/11.
Of course he did. That was the whole thing. Yeah. Come on. I mean, Cheney still says it. Cheney still pumps the big lie out. Here, listen to this. The head of Al-Qaeda-linked groups in Iraq said the country has become a university of terrorism, producing highly qualified warriors since the 2003 U.S.-led invasion. It wasn't before. And the largest batch of soldiers for jihad in the history of Iraq are graduating, and they have the highest level of competence in the world. From the military point of view, one of the enemy devils was right in saying that if Afghanistan was a school of terror, then Iraq is a university of terrorism. So we are less safe now. Plus, we've killed 600,000 Iraqi citizens and lost wounded and killed probably 30,000. Al-Qaeda, hear this too. Al-Qaeda is seeking to expand its operations. So the fact that we haven't had another terrorist attack is hopefully is a result of finally, once the horse is out of the barn, that they close the barn door. But as we see from everywhere from, Baghdad to Israel, that if people are determined to carry out terrorist acts, they're going to do it.
Right. That's why, like you said earlier, if someone gets their hands on a gun, they're going to be able to do something whether they want to or not. Or whether security can stop them or not, it's going to happen. If someone's determined they got the gun, they're going to do it. And that has nothing to do with gun control. That has to do with the person and the culture.
Listen, if the guns are easily available, people, and you have a society that is so in a process of emotional meltdown like this one is, there's more of an opportunity for people to do stuff like that. But people, gun owners and gun enthusiasts and Second Amendment protectors and what have you, I mean, there's no need to fear. I mean, the Republicans certainly aren't going to introduce any legislation to even, reinstate the assault rifle ban that the Republicans let expire in 2004. And certainly the Democrats aren't either. So there's nothing to worry about. We'll still have 200 million guns in this country. And you might say, hey, given how few people are massacred, that's not a bad rate. 200 million guns and, a million people in a decade killed and injured.
That
ain't bad.
Yeah.
All right, thanks, JJ. 313-298-WRIF. Let's see here. Here's Chris. Chris is listening in Ann Arbor. Welcome to the broadcast.
Hello, Pete.
Hi.
I would like to talk about guns. Obviously, that's the topic. But first, I want to tell you that I am on the far left of the political spectrum. That's mostly your fault due to 10 years of listening.
Oh.
But anyway...
you need to thank him. That's what you need to do.
Oh, I do. I appreciate Herman and Chomsky and Zen and all the good websites. And
he said Zen, not Zen. But you should get turned on to Zen.
Howard too. Zen. And be Zen. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, anyway, one thing I've been hearing the right say this week, they commented how on all these shootings, these mass shootings, always take place in gun-free zones.
Yeah.
Where, I tend to agree with them, where if, you know, a professor here and there went through certain training, which I have friends that have concealed weapons, and it's pretty intense, you know, classes you have to take, and the paperwork is incredible, and it's restricted to where they can go. You know, one of the places you can't take it is onto a campus.
Right.
But, I mean, say a few professors, a few students that, you know, went through the courses were obviously mentally sound, where, you know, if the laws functioned as they should have been, this guy never would have had a weapon because he was, you know, admitted to a psychiatric place.
Right.
So,
The insane Nugent call for everyone being armed. I was thinking of what as you were speaking, Chris. And yeah, so you'd have millions more people, absolutely untrained, no idea what their internal, you know, mechanism is with weapons. Yeah, that would be pretty crazy. The idea, though, that we, I mean, who knows? Maybe we need this. Like, I hate intrusions into my privacy, but when I'm flying, like I'm flying to New York on Thursday, and Julian, you're flying to Iowa. They got planes that go to Iowa?
All the way to Iowa.
Yeah. So, I don't object to any kind of security.
Alan's flying to Vegas on Tuesday. All three of us
We're
are
all
flying.
Going, yeah. Well, I don't object to any kind of security on airplanes.
Me neither.
But that never gets to the root of why the hell are we in this situation as a society to begin with, and in the case of domestic people just going, you know, citizens of the United States just going crazy because they got a bad job report, like the guy in Houston at the NASA headquarters. I mean, why are there so many insane people in this society? Well, you might say, well, while you're waiting to find out, I would sure like to not have someone come into my son's classroom and start blowing people away. So those arguments are, they bear weight because of what we've become.
Right, that's a whole separate issue. Like you're talking about, why is it happening? But the question that, and I think maybe when you said the right wing had absolutely no compassion about this because, you know, immediately when it was happening, they were saying, give everybody guns, more guns, more guns. But it's because they were trying to answer the question. I mean, one question is, why is this taking place? But the important question is, how do you prevent this stuff? And, you know, if say, like I said, a couple students were armed, a couple professors, you know, maybe the guy kills three people. And then, bam.
Yeah, you never can tell. Look at the Second Amendment. This is always argued and has been argued in the courts. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Many people have argued this, just not. This wasn't well hung together, and the first clause doesn't hang together well with the right with the last part of it. But the argument is often that there is no right of individuals to keep and bear arms, that it had to do with the state militias and all that. But like I said, I mean, it's not, in some ways, it's not even worth arguing about because absolutely nothing is going to change. I don't even think they'll wind up banning assault rifles or these magazines that can hold numerous shells. All right, I got to go real quick. Thank you. Appreciate it. We'll be right back. 313-298-WRIF.
This is WRIF.
with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back. Jalene Jordan, welcome back to you as
thank
well.
You.
Our phone number is 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Our internet is completely down, so I'm not going to get any emails till later in the night or in the morning. And my website, Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E.com, and you can go to myspace.com/nightcalldetroit and become our friend, whatever the hell that means. Don't tell me either. If you, either you know it
you're
or you don't.
You're starting to yeah. get a hang of it.
And I was right. It is savenetradio.org, savenetradio.org. It wasn't coming up because our whole station is all down. But if you enjoy listening to the Night Call and the Peter Werby Show, which will be following this at 1 a.m. on the Internet, it might be a thing of the past, given this whole deal with increased royalties that will make it absolutely financially impossible. Also, the people that stream our show at radiopower.org, they will be history as well. So it'll all be a corporate thing. But in fairness, our corporation is fighting this.
Good.
Yeah, because we want to keep streaming.
Oh, absolutely.
Now, we can go back to our phones and continue to talk about this West Virginia massacre. But I wanted, let me see, what order should I read this? Well, we'll do this. In Iraq, they're going to send this plane called the V-22, which is going to replace the Vietnam-era helicopters that are increasingly facing enemy fire. The limitations on the V-22, which cost $80 million apiece,
whoa,
this very airplane,
whoa,
means it cannot evade enemy fire with the same maneuvers and sharp turns used by helicopters. As a result, the craft could be more vulnerable to attack and may result in the Marines keeping it out of the thick of battle, using it instead for less dangerous tasks. Now, this, it's called the Osprey, and I mean, that's such a wonderful bird, an Osprey. And as they say, it's had a checkered safety record. It's cost, I think, something like billions. So we got here $80 million for this one plane, and we're wondering what in the hell are we even doing in Iraq, let alone sending more planes over there. And Republican Mitt Romney, who was the governor of Massachusetts, although born in, he's the son, isn't he, of the former governor of Michigan? Well, that you weren't here then. George Romney, he says we need to increase defense spending. This is the United States is spending $500 billion a year, and with no discernible enemies. You say, "Oh, what about all those foreign terrorists?" Well, that's what you not. You don't need Ospreys to fight terrorists. You need them to fight wars, and it ain't working very well over there. In the meantime, I'm going to announce this. Here's a bowling fundraiser for Lynn Esel Trotter. And I'm probably butchering both her names. It's I-S-E-L-E hyphen or T-R-E-U-T-E-R. Now, Lynn is fighting cancer, and her friends and family, her people in her community, are putting together a benefit Sunday, May 6th at Bowl One Lanes in Troy. And if you email me, I will send you more information because this is pretty hard to get. And you know, when people in our communities are hurting, whether sometimes it's financially, oftentimes, as the public service director of WRIF, I often get these requests for putting out information like this, and I always do it the best I can. But and it's good that we're taking this on ourselves, but can you imagine this, that we're spending $80 million on one plane?
Right.
That has a checkered safety record, and Lynn and her friends and family have to put together a bowling benefit in order to help her fight cancer.
To help her pay her hospital bills.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Absolutely wrong.
Yeah, it is. It's
just sickening. It just makes me sick to my stomach.
I don't know how many times we can say this. Every other country in the world that calls itself industrial has a government-paid health program where people aren't thrown on the resources of... let me see if I have...
You have to say, with everything that happened this week, and, you know, I let the Iraq stuff... I admitted I cry every single day about it. But this was just one of, really, speaking of depression, one of the most depressing week for me. I had a hard time getting out of it. Still not out of it. And I guess it's because I have a conscience.
I don't know. I thought I had this, too. It was in the Sunday New York Times. that that in these southern states, in these really poor rural areas, is that all the health statistics are beginning to nosedive, and this affects costs, you know, of course, children. I mean, folks, we don't have to run our world and our country like this. These elites running this, I mean, they should be fired. If this was a company, imagine if this was a company filled with insane people, with people that all they wanted to do is fight and hurt other people, that couldn't run the company financially, let alone think about this as your family, with an abusive father, with a father that lied to you all the time, that looked at your email, for instance, and listened in on your phone call, that was bankrupting the family because of his extraordinary expenditures and his giveaways to his rich buddies instead of spending it on the family. We got to fire the elite of the world without a doubt. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Joe in Detroit. Joe, hi. It's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter, Jolene. Hi, both
hi.
Of you.
Hi.
First, I just want to make a comment about the Don Imus incident. You know,
Don Imus, doesn't that sound like about 8 years ago?
It sure
does. Go ahead.
Well, you know, even though I don't agree with anything the guy says, and I would never listen to him because, frankly, I find him sort of boring, it's
Thank
sort
you.
Of another strike against free speech. You know, in order to protect our free speech, we have to protect people that we don't agree with.
Well, I agree with you, except that has absolutely nothing to do with free speech. My boss could come in here tomorrow and say, you know, I don't like the way you part your hair. You're fired. Or he could say, you know, I think your opinions are horrible.
You called someone so-and-so a moron. You're out.
Yeah,
so,
right.
Whatever.
Yeah, that's not free speech. Free speech is our right for public political speech, and that doesn't include on the airwaves. I mean, as a broadcaster, as I said last week, that it makes me nervous when I think of myself and Jolene as, in a sense, at risk broadcasters, because people object to what we're saying frequently. I mean, less and less so, of course, but there were times, you know, 3 years ago or 4 years ago now, you know, right at the beginning of the Iraq invasion, that, you know, that I would say we were definitely at risk. In fact, we were on.
We lost quite a few affiliates.
Yeah, we were at a national show and we were losing affiliates. I was going to say left and right, or actually right and right.
right.
But I don't, you know, those are corporate decisions, and the fact that big corporations control media. We work for a small corporation.
Well,
so we're not talking about you, boss.
And an excellent corporation at that.
Yeah, we love them. Yeah, and we suck.
But, you know, I think that the network, it was CBS finally, right?
Yeah.
I think that they felt they had to set a precedent.
Well, a lot
because
of it,
so many of these incidents, as of late, have been popping up.
Well, I'll tell you, if the advertisers would have stayed there, so there's more corporations,
yeah,
would have been okay.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I keep forgetting about that almighty dollar, Peter.
I heard that after we did our show last week, that there was a tremendous amount of internal pressure within the company itself that found Imus so reprehensible, and that, you know, he had a long history of making racist and anti-Semitic, and so that it wasn't like anything new. But somehow, with doing that to these fine young women, that really crossed the line. But I'm sorry, go ahead.
Question.
Yeah, go ahead.
You know, I really don't know because of my age. I was born in 1967, but it seemed to me that in the early 70s, there were a lot of taking over planes. And how did we deal with security back then?
I mean,
it seems like it's a little different than how we're dealing with it now.
They didn't have any security. You could just go, you know, go in there, light up a cigarette, and...
Oh, remember that?
Yeah. Yeah, there wasn't any. They finally figured out after 9/11, we ought to have a little security here.
So now we have to have small bottles of shampoo.
Yeah.
Woo!
Yeah.
Here's my shoes.
All right, thank you, Joe. Here's my shoes.
Here's my shoes, my belt, and here's my small bottles of shampoo. I'm safe.
Let's see here. Here's Dawn. Dawn's in Oakland Township. Dawn, it's Peter and Jolene. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air. Hi.
Hi, you guys. Thank you very much. I was calling about what you guys were talking about with the war in Iraq,
yeah.
President Bush,
yeah.
And everything. And I have to say that I disagree with a lot of what you both have said.
Okay.
I don't quite agree with all of it.
Yeah. But
I agree with the fact that we the fact that we went in Iraq misled, was a mistake. But I think that...
That should say it all right there. I mean, the story ends.
Well, no, that was a Republican and a Democrat decision from President Clinton.
True. From President Clinton. What?
How did Clinton get in this?
When Clinton was president, he agreed that we needed to war with Iraq because he thought Saddam Hussein was a threat.
Well, I don't even know.
We went over there. He sent him over there once.
Whether that's.
But he didn't start this.
In a way, that's neither here nor there. He'd been gone for like 3 years.
It was more of a sanction situation. Yeah. And I don't know if you know this. What is her name? I'm sorry.
Dawn.
I don't know if you know this, Dawn, but because of the sanctions that were put against Iraq and Saddam Hussein, 1 million civilians in Iraq died. 1 million. And that was when we weren't even at war with them.
So in some ways, Bush is responsible for killing less. But there's a bipartisan, I mean, I don't know to some extent why I was disagreeing with you. There has been, over the last 15, 16 years, this horrendous assault on Iraqi civilian society. I mean, that's who paid the cost. I mean, that's who always pays the cost. I mean, in Vietnam, it was the civilians, 3 million civilians that paid the cost. In Korea, it was 1 million Korean civilians that paid the cost.
20 minutes to get on the air with you?
What's that?
Are you, going to let me talk?
Go ahead. But, I mean, I'll tell you, that does not increase your chances of talking, but go ahead. Go ahead.
But the fact remains that, yes, we did invade their country under false pretenses with WMUDs, but nobody knew that. And even under the Clinton administration, nobody knew that. And we went under there with President Bush in power for a couple months when 9/11 happened.
You've got your dates and your history all cockeyed. January 10th, 2001. Bush takes over. September 11th, 2001, it occurs. So Clinton was just back at his Harlem office playing the saxophone when that all occurred. But he still had his security advisor that became the Bush security advisor, telling them that you got to step up security, that you got to make Al-Qaeda a real priority, and the Bush mob totally ignored all of that.
7 months. They admitted themselves that they had that plan, in fact, in place for years.
Well, wait a minute. Tell me.
Now we're agreeing.
Wait.
Right?
Tell me your. Maybe I'm missing. Summarize your point. Tell me your point. What are you trying to say?
Because I think that you're blaming everything on Bush, and I think that it's completely unfair because the man was in. And I'm not a Bush fan. Don't get me wrong. I think that going into Iraq was probably a big mistake. At the time, I was for it, like everybody
most people
in the Senate.
Yeah. Wait, no. Not our two senators, both Debbie Stabenow and Carl Levin, voted against the war, what do they call it, the War Authorization Act, as did the majority of Michigan congressmen as well. And so in the Senate, so did 22 other, I think, all Democrats voted.
Levin both voted that Saddam Hussein had to be taken out a couple years prior to Bush being elected. That is an uncontestable fact.
Well, whatever.
Send it to us.
Yeah.
Show it to us.
You're not right. But in any event, there was opposition within the Senate. But who probably never should be forgiven for their vote, people like John Kerry, John Edwards, Hillary Clinton, all voted for the War Authorization Act.
And now they are backtracking.
Yeah. They, like Carl Levin and Debbie Stabenow, knew there were no weapons of mass destruction. They knew Bush was lying. And to their everlasting shame, they voted him the go-ahead. But if you want to, I mean, I'm not a Clinton defender. I mean, fine. If you want to hook it up with, I mean, let's do it accurately and historically. But I don't have any reason to defend Clinton. But if it was the fabrications, the knowing fabrications of Bushco, then they are the ones that should be, in fact, impeached. There's the war itself, let alone the violation of federal statutes against wiretapping, the authorization of torture, makes him more than liable to be impeached and driven out of office the way he should be. All right, Don, I got to go. Sorry. 313-298-WRIF is our phone number. And here's Mike. Mike's in Royal Oak. Mike, it's Peter and Jolene. Hi.
How are you doing?
Good.
Hey, you guys have been talking on and off tonight about like military and gun control and things like that. And I just wanted to see if I could run a thought I had by get your opinion on it and relating the two.
Sure.
You know, our army is a, or our military is a voluntary military. And I was just wondering, and you were also talking about the fear of the students in the classrooms, you know, and just the fear that, you know, typical American has. And yeah. I was just wondering that, you know, I had a roommate in college once who was from Taiwan. They were required as part of their citizenship to spend 2 years in the military.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering that if we had some, like, what do you think, if we had something similar, if we had, you know, a required, as part of being an American citizen, we were required to serve our country. And, you know, personally, I think that that might give us a better understanding of what it means to be an American citizen.
Well, part of the problem, Mike, is we have so many people in this country, you'd wind up with a military of, like, 20 million people or something, right?
Right. But I think, you know, it could be, isn't the typical term, like, 4 years? But even if we cut it down to, like, say, a year in service,
it would
provide Americans with a sense of, you know, one, a sense of pride of country and of honor. But it would also give people a chance to be familiar with weapons, with tactics, with, you know, things that are, you know, capable of helping you survive.
Well, I hear you, but no one is going to introduce a bill for universal military conscription.
My ass would be in Canada so fast.
But maybe other people have a comment on it. I appreciate it. 313-298-WRIF.
Open to all kinds of ideas.
Thank you, Mike.
Just not that one for me.
Hey, I just got a little message here saying we are back online.
Fabulous.
So let's see if it in fact does it. There's that thing going, which is, I don't know whether it is or not. In terms of what the Army is currently facing, the disastrous state, this is the way this, let me see who's putting it, Yahoo News, ain't connected. All right. The disastrous state of the U.S. military is putting the country in strategic peril, a retired U.S. general said on the eve of a showdown between President George W. Bush and Democrats over paying for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Even as he offered a blistering critique of the Pentagon, retired General Barry McCaffrey on Tuesday urged Congress to approve Bush's $100 million funding request. So, I mean, he's on Bush's side on that, but imagine that. He says the state of the U.S. military is disastrous. It puts the country in strategic peril.
And that, he's pretty high up there, that McCaffrey.
Yep. And
that says a lot, Peter.
Yeah, I think so. And stress. Here, another article in today's New York Times. Military cites negligence in aftermath of Iraq killings. A military investigation has found that senior Marine Corps commanders in Iraq showed a routine disregard for the lives of Iraqi citizens that contributed to a willful failure to investigate the killing of 24 unarmed Iraqis by Marines in 2005. So that's what happens when you have that type of war, when you have that type of enemy. And who's the enemy? It's the Iraqi people.
Yeah, and you know what I always say? I think these guys and women, these young men and women, I should say, don't know who they're aiming at.
Well, what have we found out? The Sunnis want us out of there. The Shiites want us out of there.
Yeah.
And the American people want us out of there.
Right.
And Bush's idea is that if we kill enough people, if we turn enough of it into, I guess, into an urban wasteland, that somehow, quote, will win.
Hey, but there's a wall that may be built.
Oh, no.
Come on now. It's been halted, I know.
It's been halted, yeah. How about this?
Another wall.
You know, never mind. Maybe they're an advertiser. I better be nice. The Sunday Detroit Free Press. You know, I always say, if you're not from Detroit, you say the Detroit Free Press. If you're from Detroit, you say the Detroit Free Press, right?
You know, what's really funny is I'm not from Detroit, but I say the Detroit Free Press.
Well, because you've been here.
Ah, yeah, that's true.
But they are now carrying McClatchy newspaper articles, which has turned out to be the best source for information on any number of things. But the whole idea was, remember, that we had to train Iraqi forces to take over from the Americans so that they would be responsible for their own security. Well, the huge headline, and local papers do not do much national or international reporting anymore because people don't get it from papers. They get it from other sources.
The internet mainly, right?
U.S. plan backs off training of Iraqis. Policy shift and trust security to American troop buildup. Military planners have abandoned the idea that training Iraqi troops will enable U.S. troops to start coming home and now say American forces will have to defeat the insurgents and secure control of troubled provinces.
Now, I wonder if it's because a lot of the Iraqis aren't wanting to show up because they don't want to die.
Yeah, and plus they're all in these death squads. And wait a minute. You're fighting this intractable guerrilla movement, these insurgents that have, in fact, one of them, I got too much stuff here, but one of them is saying that they now are developing, and I don't know whether they're blowing smoke or not, but they say they're developing a missile that will have the same capacity that some of the sophisticated weaponry that the U.S. have. So we might be the kind of thing where they might have a missile that they'll be able to just send into the green zone.
Is this like the Chinese missile that shot up and got the satellite?
No, this would just be a battlefield
missile.
Okay, yeah, all right. So let me see. Maybe now I can't find it. But we have a situation where the United States is essentially fighting Iraqis and there's about 1,000 Al Qaeda members in there. That's pretty small.
That's the estimated number now?
Yeah. And so, but there are tens of thousands of insurgents that are Iraqis of Sunnis and of Shiites that want to drive the U.S. out. That's, folks, us. That's our kids. That's our brothers. That's our husbands. That's our uncles. Whoever. The connection. Our neighbors. And they are over there trying to defeat the people whose country it is. Hello?
Yeah. And what are these it's mostly men, the insurgents. There are female, that have blown themselves up and things like that. But what are they supposed to do? They have no jobs anymore. They have half of them have no electricity anymore. They have nothing. They may not even have homes. What are they supposed to do with their lives now?
Well, the United States has tens of thousands of Iraqi men in these prisons, in these horrible conditions, and guess what they are recruited into when they when they're in those prisons? Yeah, right. The insurgents. A lot of them weren't insurgents to begin with, but
they became insurgents.
Yeah, sure, because they are.
A shocker, Peter.
Yeah. Let's go back to our phones. Peter and Jolene at 313-298-WRIF. Here's Steve in Ann Arbor. Steve, welcome to the broadcast.
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
Yeah, just wanted to mention a couple of things. One was the categories as far as carrying firearms or being able to buy firearms. One, you have to be over 18. The other, you cannot have any felonies. And the term that I think you guys are looking for is being adjudicated insane.
Right, right.
Which means a judge basically has to declare you insane. It's elite. You have to go through the courts in order for someone not to be able to bear a firearm.
Okay.
So, well,
being institutionalized does not exempt you from carrying a firearm.
That's something that's national? Every state's different, I thought.
Well, there is a federal, there are some federal laws, statutes that govern gun dealers and some, I think there has to be some Brady Bill background checks and what have you. But one of the things I tend to do when these issues like this come up is I tend to tune out. But I remember seeing that they said that Cho should not have been eligible to get the guns that he did.
There is a reason that he was unable to,
right,
supposedly.
Right. So in other words, the judge would not have been able to, would not have declared him insane, which is probably the reason why he was able to get any firearms.
Well, he wasn't. Someone else can enlighten us about this. He was not adjudicated at all. It was, I don't know. I'm having trouble remembering. But someone else will help us out. Thank you, Steve. I appreciate it. Thanks for calling in from Ann Arbor. 313-298-WRIF. Let's go to Gary in Indiana. Hey, what do you mean? Are you in Gary, Indiana, or are you Gary in Indiana?
Gary in Indiana.
Yeah, I bet you've heard that before, huh?
Yeah.
Never.
Okay. Never, yeah.
Yeah, I was just actually I was going to touch base on but with the guy that had called a couple, I think it was a couple calls ago, about the national service idea.
Yeah.
I think I'm not sure. I think it may have been on Mike's program, Mike Molloy, but a caller put in, and I thought it's probably the best plan I've heard. And you know that would require everyone when they turn 18 either to join the military or join something like AmeriCorps or you know it's a you know community service national service program and you know you're in that program and by doing that you also get your college education free you know
that's a payback. But and, what about you know, what about what I asked the I'm sorry I can't remember the caller that suggested it but that I said we have so many people in this country would wind up with a national service program of tens of millions of people.
But I mean if you think about it look at all that needs to be done. I mean you know that I mean it doesn't necessarily have to be working in a hospital. I mean they could be working on our roads. They could be working in our parks, you know, our parks. I mean, there are so much stuff that needs to be done.
Well, I agree with you.
Okay. It just doesn't sound very free to me.
No. How about, it sounds like a chain gang. How about doing that all with union labor, union wages?
Well, I agree with that, too. But at this point, I think that, I mean, I don't know. Things are in such bad shape at this point that I think that the actual number of people that could be put in with national service, you know, would be a great help. I mean, labor has got to get back into, I mean, we've got to get labor back in, but until we get rid of the free trade agreements and all that, I don't think that we're going to, I mean, we're fighting a losing battle right now.
Yeah.
Many losing battles.
Hey, Gary, I just read this today. I just got my copy of the April 2007 Free Thought Today. It's published by the Freedom From Religion Foundation. It's FFRF.
And don't freak out when we say that.
Why? Who?
Because
Gary?
when people hear the Freedom From Religion.
Let them freak out.
Well, you know, this is a former pastor who created this, right?
Oh, I mean, what I'm going to talk about? Oh, I thought you meant
the organization.
Oh, yeah. The Freedom From Religion Foundation was formed by. But here, in Indiana, this is why I bring this up to you. Let's see, what is it here? The Indiana Family and Social Services Administration, the FSSA, has hired a Baptist minister last year at a salary of $60,000 a year. And his job is to serve as a chaplain for the FSSA. And they're supposed to do Christian counseling for the employees of the state agency.
Wait a minute. What was that whole thing about state and church?
And separation.
Separation, right.
Well, our friends at the
Freedom... Amazing how that creeps in.
Freedom From Religion Foundation is suing, saying that... it fosters an excessive entanglement with religion, do you think? That it pays a member of the clergy with taxpayer money to provide religious faith-based counseling and has no volunteer minute, or that has doesn't do anything for a secular, someone who would counsel secular people. So, there's something to look out for in your state. Has that made the papers there by any chance?
Yeah, actually it has, and it doesn't, and it's nothing that surprises anyone that lives here. I mean, you know, we're talking about. I just happen to live in a blue area of a very, very red state.
Yeah.
So anything to do with religion, nothing surprises me.
Where are you calling from? What city?
Corydon, which is about 30 minutes from Louisville, Kentucky.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So you're right down there. All right, Gary, thanks for joining us.
And you know
I
what?
Appreciate
you can,
it.
You can go to FF, if I can remember this from years ago, FFRF.org.
That's pretty good, particularly since I said that about a minute ago.
Oh, I didn't hear you. I really didn't
I
hear you.
I'm only kidding. That wasn't nice.
That wasn't nice, I
apologize.
Peter Werby.
Let's see. Here's Misty in Mount Clemens. Misty, hi. It's Peter and Jolene.
Hi.
You're on the air. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Okay, well, I just want to get back to this Virginia Tech thing, man.
Okay.
Well, you know, it's just such a shame that they keep showing this guy's face.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, well.
I mean, I agree.
Well, yeah,
agree
like enough.
You.
Yeah, could you imagine being in that classroom and, like, having to experience it hand-on-hand, and then NBC, ABC, whatever.
Yeah.
Everyone all the networks.
Showing his face all over town. Oh my God! What a nightmare!
It is a nightmare. It's a frightening visage.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the networks have backed off at this point. I think.
Well, you know, enough is enough.
Well, I agree. The students, by the way, have asked the media to leave the campus.
These splooges, you still see it all, man.
Yeah. Well.
But you know what? I have a suggestion for you. Just don't turn it on.
Well, that is, and I don't know if you heard earlier.
But turn it off.
We were reading an op-ed piece by someone who said, do yourself a favor and don't look at it. Because, I mean, like I said back then, I don't want those images seared into my memory in that manner. I mean, I can, the knowledge of it, that it happened, and you can extrapolate from each death about how much grieving and how many lives are going to be sad till the end of their days.
And you visualize what these people went through.
And I don't have to see this guy. Yeah. No. All right, we got to take a break, so thank you for joining us and be the last caller in this segment. We got one more segment, though, so don't go away. In the meantime, you can call 313-298-WRIF. Peter and Jalene will be right back.
WRIF.com. On WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. And joining me, Jalene Jordan, 313-298-WRIF. This is our last segment, although we go up till 1 a.m. At 1 a.m., you'll hear an interview I did with Greg Palast. He has written a book called Armed Madhouse. Armed Madhouse, not about what just happened either, but it's called, subtitle is From Baghdad to New Orleans, Sordid Secrets and Strange Tales of a White House Gone Wild.
Wow.
Yeah.
What a title.
And also Gene Bauer, president of Farm Sanctuary, America's leading farm animal protection organization. Interesting man. Two good interviews, by the way, so stay tuned for that. Let me see here. We'll go back to our phones, and we'll go to Ted. Ted is in somewhere. Where are you? Where are you calling
from? Ted in Crawford?
No.
Please, no.
Ann Arbor?
Oh, Ann Arbor. Go ahead.
I have kind of an open-ended question. It's kind of a big question.
Yeah.
And I'm actually would like to take the answer off air because my phone's going to run out of batteries. But
sure.
Why do you think it is that Americans are so complacent, especially with respect to their government and the way that they're being represented to the rest of the world?
Okay, we'll take it off there. It's simple and it's complex at the same time. We have wound up to be a totally atomized society, that the culture has worked to split us up into little fragments of individual consumers that do not have the power to unite to carry out social policy that affects us all. So we are then dependent on elites to do whatever has to be done for us. And, of course, the elites only serve themselves. And if you look back in the heyday of mass movements, of beginning, well, how this society was begun, the abolitionist movement, the women's suffrage, the anti-war movements before World War I and during the Vietnam War, the union movement, the civil rights movement, the feminist movement, the gay movement, those things. These were people that were linked together by either common ethical beliefs in terms of like abolishing slavery and segregation, or, when, of course, with segregation, that was both the people affected directly, and that we've lost that capacity. Now, people sometimes tell me, nobody's doing anything. And I unkindly say to them, well, I say, well, what are you doing? And they go, well, yeah, I guess I'm not doing anything either. And I said, I'm not being critical of you. If you said to me, what can I do tomorrow to change this society, I wouldn't have any, I wouldn't have the most effective way in the world. I mean, we still do not have the mass movements of resistance and renewal, because we had to be positive, too. We have to have the only thing of this horrible man's horrible father, the first Bush. He said, he talked about the vision thing. Remember another one of his, he couldn't talk either.
But, he was a little better.
Yeah, he was a little better. But we have to create a vision thing. We have to think about what is possible. You know that slogan of the anti-globalization movement, a new world is possible. Well, it is possible. Anything is possible if we make it happen. But we have to fill in what we really want to see. We have to have a vision of what is workable and what is equitable and what is ethical. And what, we're in a totally defensive mode. We hate Bush, we hate Bush, we hate Bush. Well, so what? He just goes on doing what he wants. That's all negative, and that's good. But we have to, I think, travel beyond that and start figuring out what we want our lives to be about. Do we want to be huddled in classrooms? Do we want to always be worried whether the economic rug is going to be pulled out from under us? Are we going to have to spend the rest of our lives worrying about, because of the United States invasion of here or there, that someone's going to take another terrorist poke at us? Not a way to live. Are we going to live out our lives always wondering whether the person next to us is going to go nuts? Well, that's our choices, and they're hard ones, because if there was the mass movement for resistance and renewal, and I could say to you, hey, all you got to do is go to, I bet you there is a website, resistanceandrenewal.org, and join up, and you'll be part of this mass movement. That would be pretty easy. I don't have anything like that to tell you right now. We're still floundering around, and we better find our bearings, because if things get worse and worse and worse, like about the environment, we get to a point where there may be no turning back. We have this sense of progress, of making the world better. I mean, that's begun since the age of the Enlightenment, 300-400 years ago. But cynicism is creeping in. We're just happy to kind of hope that our little wagon train circled will get us through. And very frequently we find out that ain't working. So
You know what else? I think that a lot of Americans are just very self-involved. I think we're gluttons in general. I think we're lazy. We watch too much TV.
Well, that's, I think, what happens.
Me, you know? me. The let me accumulate the more. Keeping up with the Joneses. I think there's a lot of that.
There is, but I think that's compensatory. When real authentic community has been just sucked out of our lives, where we're not connected to each other the way we used to be, then, yeah, maybe I can buy more things.
I can watch
more television, and I can, you know, get more clothes and more things.
Yeah, get your new SUV. You know, I see a relative of mine, their neighborhood, you know, I guarantee you, I don't want to guarantee, but I'm going to go out on a limb and say not one of those families gives one hoot what's going on in Iraq. To be honest, they're so involved in the birthday parties and, you know, Susie's new Easter dress and things like that, that, you know, these people, I go in, I feel like an alien. I want to talk about these things.
Well, I don't mean to let anyone off the ethical hook, because ultimately, if we're not motivated in our lives by ethical centering, I mean, what are we? And yet, I mean, I think people withdraw from public life because they feel there's no chance to do anything. And they try to, you know, the most...
Helpless, huh?
Yeah, they feel helpless, and they try to accentuate ultimately what life's all about, which is, you know, if you think about it, it is all about families and birthday parties.
True,
and,
I know.
Yeah, but, I mean, you know, if there's people being murdered down the block, and...
And you see it on the news, and you say, oh, isn't that terrible? And then, boom, oh, got to get Sally to soccer. You know... What I'm saying
here?
Yeah,
I do. I mean, I don't know. Well, maybe we can... Is there anybody else?
Maybe someone... Are there people on the phones?
Yeah, right.
There's lots of people on the
phones. Here's Jeff in Toledo. Jeff, it's Peter and Jalene. You're on the air.
Hi, guys.
Hi.
How you doing?
Good.
Listen, this is what's happening, and this is what people don't understand. Okay, and I have an example, a perfect example. The U.S. military, we spend more money on the United States military in this country than any other country, all other countries combined.
Right.
Right? Correct.
Right, right.
Yes.
Okay. There's a new armored personnel vehicle that is impervious to roadside bombs, anti-tank shells, things like this. Okay.
Yeah.
This is a nice new APC. The military, the U.S. military, has taken delivery of less than 200 of these vehicles. Okay.
Yeah.
The company that produces them has produced over 10,000 of these vehicles.
So where are they?
They're in Virginia.
Oh.
And they're painted black. Blackwater has taken delivery of them.
Oh, come on. Not 10,000.
No, they have.
Not 10,000.
No, this is what's going on. No.
What's your source?
10,000 of them.
Oh.
But I'm saying they are taking delivery of a large quantity of them to parallel the United States military. The United States military is suffering, and we're spending all this money, okay? Now, they're in Iraq simply to cap the oil production. Saddam Hussein went to the euro.
Instead of the dollar.
Yeah.
He never got that far.
Right. Why didn't he?
Right. Hello.
But it's to cap that oil so that OPEC can keep the oil prices up.
Right.
And these people can make this money. And what they're doing is these people are pouring money into Blackwater. Now, we've seen this before. Adolf Hitler did this.
Wait, before you go any further, let's tell people that what Blackwater, in case they missed, for instance, my interview I did with the author of the book about Blackwater, Jeremy Scahill, that this is what they call a military contractor. It used to be called mercenaries, but they don't like that phrase. But it's the privatization of the military that are outside of civilian control, outside of the justice system that our soldiers are. Do you know the book?
Yeah, right, and I've heard. Yeah, I haven't read it, but yeah, but exactly. And this is the thing. This is not new. Adolf Hitler did the same thing during World War II. They got the SS divisions, the Waffen-SS, got the best of the new equipment, the very best of everything, the Panthers, the Tigers, everything. Okay, and what it does is it creates a private army that parallels the national army.
Yeah.
And the reason for that is simple. The National Army is our kids, you know, everybody's kids, they're not going to turn on their own. But these evangelical lunatics who are building this Blackwater, they want nothing more than to turn on their own.
Well, I don't. Yeah, I mean, the book is pretty frightening without even going that far, and certainly that the let me see if I can remember Eric Prince, who was who got all his money from a big three auto parts supplier. His father invented the mirror, you know, where you flip it up and on a car. What do you call those?
Oh, sure, the nighttime.
No. The sun visor, the illuminated sun visor.
Oh, yeah. I have two.
Yeah, you know when you're like going, you're looking, and you say, "Got any spinach in my teeth?" Yeah, and so he's far right wing evangelical. They've he and his family and his friends have contributed hundreds of thousands of dollars to the Republicans. He's married to the sister of Dick DeVos from Amway. It's the deeper you get into this, this right wing cabal.
I'll take my Republican dad over any of those people.
All right, Jeff, thanks for bringing that up. 313-298-WRIF. Here is Lars. Lars, hi. It's from Madison Heights. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter and Julie. I just wanted to comment on the assault weapons ban.
Sure, that was in for 10 years, and in 2004, Bush let it expire, and the Republicans did.
Well, if you look at the terminology of the bill, it didn't actually ban assault weapons.
Yeah, you couldn't import any, right?
Well, that was in 1989, there was the import ban. That one is still in effect, but it banned the manufacture in the United States. But it defined an assault weapon based on, basically, it was a semi-automatic rifle that looks like an assault rifle.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
so it's like if all the manufacturers had to do is remove the bayonet lug and the threading at the end of the barrel, and it was legal. So.
Right. Everybody, you know, all the right-wingers are saying, Clinton's taking our guns away, you know, and that assault ban. And in fact, I appreciate that correction because it makes it sound like there was a strict ban on assault weapons and ammunition and all that, and it really didn't do much at all, did it?
No, it was just a fluff piece because, like, gun control is like the Democratic... Like, they're like, oh, we got to look like we're doing something. We'll, you know, give some bill with a good, like, the Child Protection Act or whatever and pass it, and even though it doesn't do anything. And
oh, no child left behind.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, and the Republicans, it's immigration because they can't fix the economy. They can't fix health care. They can't fix a dozen other things, but they can build a wall on Mexico and look like they're doing something.
Well, that's always what these politicians want. Keep everything the same. And you just kind of throw some raw meat to the base. And that's one of the things that, for instance, the Democrats will do. They'll probably figure, they'll say, well, we got to respond some way to this latest massacre. And we don't want to be against, we don't want to be for gun control because then we may lose some voters. So they're not thinking of solutions. They're thinking of votes for themselves.
They're trying to figure out how to save their asses. That's what they're trying to do.
There you go. All right. Thanks a lot, Lars. Thanks for that correction and information.
So repulsive.
313-298-WRIF. Let's see. Here is Josh. Josh is calling from Waterford. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter.
Hi.
Hey, I just called. You guys had a caller probably, I'd say, half hour ago talking about joining the military when you turn 18 and, you know, they do your college or whatever. You know, just a mandatory involvement in the military for everyone once you turn 18.
Yeah, usually they call that a national service. And I think we talked about this once before, and I'm not sure if I'm right, but I think, like, maybe Germany has that. Go ahead.
The reason I'm calling is I think a lot of the reasons why we don't have a lot of people joining our military right now, or at least as much as we would, is because we don't have anything to have pride in. The caller said, you know, it would build pride in our country and stuff like that. But, I mean, right now, what do we have pride in?
Yeah.
We're in a war where our president's sticking his nose where it doesn't belong. Our economy has hit the dirt. I mean, what's left?
Well, it is. And when you start getting more and more, like, again, on the front page of the New York Times today, was talking about how these American soldiers had benefited by these Iraqi soldiers torturing their prisoners. And, killings of civilians, I mean, that's what happens when you're, well, I said that before, so I won't repeat it. But for everyone concerned, we should get the hell out of there just the absolute soon as possible, I would say. All right, well, thank you very much. I appreciate your call. There was something that, what was I going after here? Oh, yeah. Pardon me. Choke. 2,000 protesters greeted Bush in East Grand Rapids, Michigan.
2,000?
Yeah. Those people in Western Michigan have, and that's up where this Eric Prince, the Blackwater mercenary guy, comes from. Yeah, it's a small suburb in south, what is it? This is a suburb of a small West Michigan town. Yeah. East Grand Rapids. Not even Grand Rapids. East Grand Rapids.
Ah.
Right? And so 2,000 people. Bush was just up there, and they came out. It's on my website.
Now, that's fabulous.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a darn good turnout. We've been to a lot of different sizes of protests.
Yeah, here in Detroit, you're lucky if you get 300 people out.
Right.
But, well, as someone said, in fact, you can go to my calendar page. You go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E. Go to the calendar page, and there's all sorts of interesting things to go to, and you can learn stuff. You can meet people. You don't have to just have this sort of mediated connection with people through just watching or even through the internet. You can actually stand in a room with people or go out on a demonstration.
Who feel the same way you do.
Yeah. Well, that's nice. Here's Stella in Hamtramck. Stella, hi. It's Peter and Jalene.
Hi, hello to you both. I just wanted to ask you, it was over a year ago, they said they were going to increase the death benefit for the fallen from $6,000 to $100,000.
That's right.
Did that ever happen?
I don't know.
I really don't think so, because I haven't heard anything else about it.
I'm kind of doubting it.
Well, you would think that the Democrats would be into doing that. I mean, it's Bush. I mean, talk about supporting our troops. Bush that shortchanged the troops on equipment and on VA care and veterans benefits and all of this. So you would think that the Democrats at a minimum would go and put this in as a bill, and I'm sure that'd be the one that Bush that he'd sign it, right?
I guess, unless there was something else attached to it.
Yeah. So we're going to see how this all plays out. Thank you, Stella.
Great question.
From calling from Hamtramck. I mean, I don't know why I'm gasping here. I'm trying to suck on this coffee. This is so unprofessional, right?
It's okay, Peter.
All right.
You're forgiven.
Detroit has two suburbs. I don't know. The other cities have this that are the Hamtramck and Highland Park, both of which are completely surrounded by the city. You know, that suburbs usually are on the outside.
Oh, okay. Right?
Yeah, but Highland Park and Hamtramck are completely surrounded. Is that unusual?
You are so full of information.
What? Oh, information.
Not useless information.
You're so full of information. Here's Colleen. Colleen, where are you calling from? It doesn't say on my screen.
Oh, hi. I'm calling from Flushing.
Flushing?
Flushing, Michigan.
Oh, okay. Not Flushing, New York.
Yeah. How are you guys?
We're good.
I just tuned in. I love your show. Listen, I'll admit first, I am so not the sharpest knife in the drawer. But I am really, really confused over what's happening. First off, my prayers are with the families and friends at Virginia Tech. It's horrible. But can you please tell me, both of you, why is there such a difference between NBC showing that sickening SOB on TV versus every network, you know, that was known to man showing us 9/11 footage? I mean, it was 24/7, making sure that, and if you think every time the clip came on, it was always those poor souls. I mean, oh, I get choked up now thinking about it, jumping out of those buildings, you know, knowing they were about to die, or hearing the things on the record, you know, talking to their moms and dads on the phone from, you know, the airplane saying goodbye. Why is it? Oh, it's horrible, but why is this? Everyone is just so outraged, and they can't believe that they did this, yet 9/11, I mean, yes, it happened to so many more people, but one life is too many.
Sure.
You know, this was in Virginia, this happened in New York, you know. I know they're two different, they're different reasons, but it's the same thing. Why? Why?
I mean, are you talking about the media coverage?
Yes. Are people just so sickened and this is horrible? And how could NBC do this? What the hell did we go through with 9/11 and all the things we see and hear?
I hate to say it, Colleen. These are people in our industry, but when something like that happens, they love it because their ratings skyrocket.
Yeah. I used to be a television news reporter, and I remember once a woman crying, and I remember, and this is when I got out. Peter, I was so happy she was crying. I got that woman to cry, and I had the interview, and I put it on, and I just, God, it was just this broadcasting power, you know. I'm a newscaster. And then I got sickened, and I went into radio after that. I said, I've enough of this noise.
You know where
but
really...
they love it, and I see it in those newsrooms. I've seen it firsthand.
Wow. You know, I gotta take one more caller because we're almost at the end of this section of the show. That's a great question, Colleen. Thank you.
Yeah.
Here is it Mina or Mina? Hello.
Mina.
Mina, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, what's going on, man?
We're doing the show. What's up?
Listen, I just want to know why is it okay to show this guy's face? You know, could you imagine being in that classroom and then having to look at his face on TV like the day after? Oh, my God, how frightening.
Well, in a way, that's what Colleen was saying right before you, and I think...
That, I know.
No, that's okay. That's okay. That's okay. I mean, because when... the reason I said that, it was because it means that a lot of people are thinking the identical thoughts. I mean, why are we being subjected to being shown this madness, this frightening horror? I'll go back to what I think Jolene said and what I was reading an essay, is that it really is time for us then to turn it off, to say the thought of it is horrific enough. We don't want to be subjected to the imagery as well. And if we are willful participants as, you know, just sort of passive observers, then it's us. And so we can always deal the networks, the cruelest blow of all, and turn them off. All right, Mina, I got to go. So thank you very much. I appreciate you being our last caller. And stay tuned. Jolene Jordan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Peter.
Next week, we're going to tell people, and we'll have it on my calendar as well. You're going to be doing playing some music from your CD, right, out in public. Or should, am I supposed to say that?
Actually, it's May 19th.
Yeah, okay. Well, we'll be wait a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
That's right. Stay tuned for Greg Pallas. He's going to be talking about his paperback edition of Armed Madhouse. Also, Gene Bauer, president of Farm Sanctuary. That's all coming up. Thanks for listening. Thanks for calling. We'll talk next week.
Listening, WRIF.com.
with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. I hope by now that Greg Palast has become a household name, at least to listeners of this program and hopefully to an expanded public in the United States. I say it like that because Greg Palast, an incredible investigative journalist, has pretty much had his light kept under a bushel, as they used to say. He's an award-winning journalist for BBC Television's Newsnight, and he does appear here in the United States. Mostly, though, the big networks want to keep Greg Palast off the air, which makes me want to put him on the Peter Werby Show. Greg Palast, welcome back to the program.
Glad to be with you, Peter, again.
And this
don't
is
tell Karl Rove.
Yeah, don't tell Karl Rove. We'll ask you what that means in just one second. Greg Palast, as I said, is an investigative journalist, and he's the author of the best-selling New York Times bestseller, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. And we spoke to him last year upon the publication of his hardcover book, Armed Madhouse, From Baghdad to New Orleans, Sordid Secrets and Strange Tales of a White House Gone Wild. And it is now out in paper. It's a plume book, and there's a brand new chapter called The Scheme to Swipe 2008. Greg Palast joins us from his New York City office. Greg, welcome back to the broadcast.
Glad to be with you, Peter. And another chapter, a secret extra chapter called Busted, about how Homeland Security charged me with violating anti-terror laws.
You know what? I'm not kidding. No, I think we talked about that.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a good story. We'll get that in again. We'll see. I mean, the amount of stories that are not brought out to the public and that you have are incredible. Now, the title of your book sounds almost unfortunate, like something that could have been written over the last week, Armed Madhouse. And already at your website, gregpalast.com, P-A-L-A-S-T, gregpalast.com, you already have a comment on that incredible the shooting and tragic result in Virginia, and you say that the shooter, the 23-year-old extraordinarily disturbed man, had accomplices. Tell us that.
Yeah,
quickly.
He did. Well, I was so fast because, frankly, it's right out of the book on Madhouse. I have a chapter called "Just Put Down That Lawsuit, Partner, and No One Gets Hurt." And here's what's going down. How did a kid who shouldn't have a plastic spoon in his hand get a Glock 7mm and a Walther P-22? And the answer is, ask, you know, Sundance George Bush. Because this is the guy who secretly, with only no one noticing, signed a law in July 2005 saying gun manufacturers are immune from lawsuits for misuse of their product.
That's incredible.
Now, you have to understand, Peter, you're not immune. I'm not immune. Teachers are not immune. Cops are not immune. Okay? Who gets immunity? Who gets immunity are the gun manufacturers. So Glock and Walter and all these Austrians and Germans who were shipping us this stuff, his guns came from Germany and Austria, you know. And so all the, you know, so now they can say we're off the hook in a court. They can say under Bush's law, you know, we were just taking, you know, just like Hitler and Bush, we were just taking orders for our guns. And so they're off the hook. And it is part of a whole scheme to let all of corporate America and Planet Corporation off the hook through immunizing many industries against lawsuits. And they began with the gun industries because the big corporations. And by the way, you know who designed this law?
Tell me.
It was a bequest from Ken Lay.
No, come on.
I'm not kidding.
The late Ken Lay, Kenny Boy from Enron.
Yeah, from Kenny Boy, who set up something called Texas for Tort Reform. And what he was trying to do was slowly increase, block the ability of people to file suits, including against guys who might rip off their corporations and their pension funds, like Ken Lay. So in other words, if you're rich enough, see, if you're Capone, you buy the judges. If you're Lay, you buy the president and the laws.
Well, Greg Palast, tell us about the Iron Pipeline. I read this, and this is just on your website. I have a link to it on my website, peterwerby.com, as well as yours, gregpalast.com. But tell us what the Iron Pipeline is.
Okay, it's a Glock and Walter that sold that made the guns, the student slayers. They are selling about 10 times as many guns into Georgia than there are Georgians. And so what happens, they're overstuffing the place where they're legally allowed to sell these beasts, And it goes up what they call through the iron pipeline, is the name that cops give it, the iron pipeline, and it poops out in states like Virginia, which have tougher laws. And they know when they're overstuffing Georgia that they're deliberately pushing the extra heat up into Virginia and into New York and up the iron pipeline.
And
that is why they were being sued by the city of New Orleans sued them, Baltimore sued them, cops have sued them, saying, you know where this stuff is ending up. They say, given the number of guns you're putting into Georgia, do you think that they're maybe using it for something other than bringing down bighorn elk? You know, it's like the P-22 that this guy had is, you know, like small as a baby's hand.
Yeah. It's a little one, but but deadly as...
It does the job if what you want to do is, give your class a final exam. And that's what's going on here. And you can't just look at, you cannot look, Peter, just at the 32 killed because the president got his nice photo op. Well, Mr. President, 30 people were shot down by this guy in Virginia. 30,000 people a year die of gunshot wounds in the United States. So, and there are no photo ops for them and no sympathy.
Yeah,
just legal immunity for the gun makers.
So those guns with, or those states with weak gun laws, like Georgia and Alabama and Virginia, the gun manufacturers know eventually they're going to wind up in New Orleans and here in Detroit, and people are going to use them in an illegal manner. I mean, there's no way that they could, you know, it reminds me, I can't even remember those famous rolling papers that people use, Zig-Zag.
Yeah, Zig-Zag. Well, exactly. In fact, I put that in the, you know, it's like, In our mad as I talk about it, just like that, you know, like Zig-Zag didn't know that not all of their customers were using their papers to roll tobacco. Okay, come on, but at least, you know, the worst thing that happened there is that some people got a little too high for high as our president or something. But that's okay. I mean, but when it's guns, it's a whole different matter. And by the way, tobacco manufacturers were even hit with massive lawsuits about overstuffing. Outlets to move contraband. So only the gun manufacturers are off the hook, but behind it was, it's weird, but behind it was Ken Lay. Ken Lay, the NRA, and the Christian Coalition as well, all put together by a wacky little lobbyist named Grover Norquist. This is all in the book. This is how it operates. It's the point of our madhouse, to give you the stories you're not supposed to get. And now you got them. See you later. No.
Yeah, well, they're in our...
As one.
They're in this, the just-released soft-cover edition of Armed Madhouse, From Baghdad to New Orleans, Sordid Secrets and Strange Tales of a White House Gone Wild. Greg Palast, the author, is my guest. Think about this, people, that when you're hearing this for the first time, whether it makes immediate sense to you or whether you're challenging it or even whether you don't believe it, why is this the first time you've heard this? That's the real question. Why does Greg Palast have to do this and not Charles, what's his name, on ABC News?
Yeah, why don't the fake
Gibson
and the bright teeth give us the news? Well, that's a very good question because... in fact, this was noted in the email just released by the Justice Committee, the House Judicial Committee, by Congressman Conyers, your local boy.
Mm-hmm.
There were 2,000 emails from Karl Rove's office, and one of them, dated February 7th of this year, is gloating that no U.S. national media picks up the investigations of what they call that British reporter, Greg Palast. And they actually attached an excerpt from Armed Madhouse. And they were gloating. Ah, no one's reading this. So, Peter, I just want to warn you, they're measuring you for an orange suit right now.
Well, I'll tell you, Greg, they're reading it. They're reading it because it's almost impossible not to. These reporters here, these editors here, are reading it in the United States, and they're making a very conscious decision. Do we want to go with some of the charges that Palast has made? And they're saying, no, we don't want to.
By the way, you're not just guessing. I have to tell you that I just got a call this week from ABC News. A civil rights attorney named Bobby Kennedy Jr., who you may know,
sure,
was saying that in our madhouse, one of the things that I had put on BBC television and put in our madhouse is the plan for stealing the 2008 election that they began in 2004 by wiping out the votes of black voters, and they did this. They did this in many states, and I believe Michigan was one of them, where they sent. Listen to this; you'll love this. The Republican Party, under Karl Rove's direction, sent hundreds of thousands of letters to soldiers and students, black soldiers and black students. The black soldiers sent overseas or students away from vacation, if when the letter was undelivered, they would say, do not forward. They would use that as evidence that the voter was voting fraudulently.
Hmm.
Go to Baghdad, and then they would challenge your vote. Go to Baghdad, lose your vote. The soldiers, like I talked to one family, this guy Randy Prouse, who was on the list, you know, his wife said, yeah, he doesn't live here. He's, you know, he's sent overseas. He's a naval airman, an African-American. And when he sent in his absentee ballot, it was challenged and thrown out, and he didn't even know it. Oh, so in other words, mission accomplished, Mr. President. Send the guys to Fallujah, and the black ones, you throw away their ballots. I love it.
Well, one of the things that you said, and this was prescient, I think we must have talked before the 2006 election. We've actually talked a number of times about these issues. And you said that just like dirty tricks that were played in 2000, just like the ones that were played in 2004, they're going to do it again in 2006. And I said, well, what can we do? And you said the main thing is that people have to vote in such numbers that they can't shave enough to really affect the outcome. And it turned out that in most of the races that was true, but there still were some pretty shaky ones, weren't there?
Okay, if you go into the new chapter in our Madhouse, I identify six congressional races that the Democrats actually won that midterm. But you know what? The Democrats should stop smiling because they are preparing for 08. They got 4.5 million votes in the bucket. And I was talking about Bobby Kennedy. He had called ABC Television News, the president of ABC Television News, and said, look, why don't you put Greg Palast's story on the air before they steal the next one? What these people have done is a crime. You cannot target black people and remove their votes, whether in Michigan or Fallujah or anywhere else. It's a crime. It's a go-to-jail crime. Why aren't you running this report? So the president of ABC News called me up and said, hello, forget it, Palast.
Wow.
I mean, in very polite, nice language. So you can get it on BBC. You can get it on Peter Werbe, who's giving, you know, breaking through the electronic Berlin Wall. And I hope your listeners understand how precious you are. Buy every product from every one of your sponsors right this minute. I mean, well, because they got us. This, your program is precious because you are breaking the omerta. And you know, that's one of the things here is that this guy, the guy that planned the attack on the voters, on the soldier voters, can you imagine? This little creep has now been appointed U.S. Attorney for Arkansas. John Conyers is holding hearings, your guy, on the firing of disloyal Republican prosecutors. But no one is focusing yet on the on who they are putting in. They're moving from criminals to creeps. And the case of this guy Griffin, who committed these crimes, as Bobby Kennedy said, reading, you know, he said, after reading Our Mass, what we got here is a situation where the perps become the prosecutors. You can't, you know, so their scheme is pretty deep and devious. And in fact, in the book, I also have talked to one of the fired prosecutors before he's fired, and I could see what happened. I was told that he was investigating cases of voter fraud. This is Karl Rove's office. There's all these illegal immigrants voting, and we got to get them off the voter rolls. And I said, give me a case. He says, call this guy Iglesias in New Mexico. I did. I said, so are you investigating these so-called fraudulent voters? And he said, no. I said, you're calling the Republican, your fellow Republican officials, liars? He was silent. I said, I'll take that as a yes. He was put on the hit list and he was removed. They want to stop you from voting. There's always work in America at Fallujah.
Yeah. Well. Oof. Hey, the book is Our Madhouse. Greg Palast, my guest on the Peter Werbe Show. Tell me a little about what you sense of the milieu in the United States. Let me kind of frame this. Greg Palast, you're going out on tour in support of this book. Unfortunately, not coming to Detroit, but there are listeners all around the country.
That's completely unacceptable, and I'm going to change publishers if they do that to me again.
Well,
they miss the Motor City.
People can probably, maybe at the last moment, go to your website and try to arrange something. But in any event, you're appearing in, and I've sort of lost this, so in that in some places you're like appearing like with comics. Is it that so much has changed over the last 4 and 5 years? 4 and 5 years ago, critics of what I call Bushco, Bush Incorporated, were on the defensive and we were just growling. Now, although the what we are critical of is still out there, it's not, you know, not well, changed greatly. At least now we have the, in a sense, the cultural upper hand, and we can laugh.
It's called the majority in a democracy,
yeah, but,
and that's why they have to. That's why they don't want the voters to influence the outcome of the elections anymore, and that's why they're changing. I mean, look at what is happening in Detroit. I mean, I do have a whole section in our Madhouse about basically the taking of the economic execution of the auto industry in Detroit and Michigan. And, you know, there is a giant sucking sound from, but not down to Mexico. What's happening is a giant sucking sound from working people to the vultures. If people are listening who are, you know, who are Delco, now Delphi workers, okay?
Yeah.
I mean, they know what's happening. They're not losing their jobs. They're just losing their pay. They still have to go to work. You know, they just don't get paid anymore. I mean, and how that has happened, and I explain how that happens through this business of the petrodollar cycle, through our, you know, the auto parts industry, Delco and Delphi, if you're out there listening, you guys know right now that you've gone from 29 plants in the USA to 8. Now, it's not that Delphi has fewer plants, it's just that they're opening in China. Same with Walmart. We have 700 Walmart plants in China, 0 in the USA. We don't have a trade deficit with China. We have a trade deficit with Walmart. We have a trade deficit with Delphi. We have a trade deficit between workers in America and corporate America. And when you talk about comics, it's so grim that if I don't make it funny, I couldn't stand it. I'm either going to be laughing or crying, so I choose to laugh.
That's great. You know, one of the so many things you've done, I didn't read. You sent along Greg Palast's biography. It would have taken probably a good 5 minutes. You've done so much. But one of the things that I noticed that you work for the United Steelworkers of America, and I just got a solicitation that the United Steelworkers are offering what they call associate members, that you don't have to work in a plant, but that you can literally join like the USW, the United Steelworkers, as a social movement.
Which is about time that started happening, because the number of people actually unionized workers in the plants now, and you know how that's going out there, is now fewer than the number of people that believe that Elvis is still here. And so we have to, you know, so there has to, it is, has to go back to the idea that this is a social movement. We're all in this together right now. And yeah, so that's, I think that's a positive thing. The question is whether it's too late. But I don't know. I'm not that grim about things. We've gone through this before in America. The labor movement was almost eliminated by between 1880 and 1930, and then boom, it came back. And it's not just a question of labor unions. It's a question of working people. Let's put it this way. There's no reason, you know, why auto workers in Japan, who get more than American workers, are producing cars than the most profitable auto corporation on the planet, Toyota. And they're paid more than American workers. So what's this crying about? We can't afford to pay the American workers. It's all about vultures buying up these companies and making billions.
I keep looking for the Chinese to buy Chrysler.
Well, actually, that's the next move. They are, in a way, because they're providing the money in the background. Basically, we have the Chinese now have $1 trillion of our money. Well, and you have to take a look at something else, too.
They have it as treasury bonds, so they're essentially have the economy because it's running out of deficit.
They're holding the mortgage to Detroit.
Yeah.
So what's happening is that, and I have a chapter in there, of course, about the secret documents for the control of the oil fields of Iraq, and it's all about making sure, not getting the oil. I mean, I was one of those people who thought we went in to get the oil. Not true. We went in to make sure we don't get the oil so that the price of oil stays up there. And you had basically a war tax at the pump, $1 a gallon. When Clinton was in, oil was $20 a barrel. Now it's over $50 a barrel. That's mission accomplished as far as this regime is concerned. You're paying extra at the pump. That's killing GM. And the money is basically floating down to Texas. This is, again, mission accomplished. You have to look at the changing demographics of Michigan. You know, they're trying to turn this into a red state.
Well, interesting.
They're happy to see it happen.
Back 10 years ago or so, the Republicans were criticizing Clinton because he had allowed the price of gasoline to go to the astronomically high price of $1.80 a gallon.
Remember, they had a revolt over him adding a nickel a gallon. Taxed. It's like, forget it, man. I mean, you're pouring silver dollars into that SUV of yours, Peter. Don't you have that yellow Hummer still? Or
yeah, I still do. Yeah.
Okay, good. And but you know, so what happens? We're paying this oil tax. It goes through the gullet of the oil companies, and it comes out. It's pooped out to Saudi Arabia, and then they lend it back to George to cover the U.S. trade deficit. Do you know that while we spend about $250 billion a year on OPEC oil, we borrow about $250 billion from these guys? We actually get more cash back than goes out, but we're borrowing it back at high interest rates. What's killing GM? It ain't your wages there, guys. What's killing GM is a threefold increase in their interest costs, besides, you know, the fact that there's murderous health care costs that this regime is more than happy to see continue head northward.
Greg Ballas, are you encouraged? Certainly the Republicans got a well-deserved kick in the butt, and now there's all these corruption investigations, and yet most of the policies continue as is because we have the type of electoral system where the executive still can control overall policy. Are we going to make it till January 20th, 2009?
Americans always make it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there's only so much junk we take. I mean, one of the things I talk about in our madhouse is that, you know, we've been here before, 1927. In 1927, the levees in New Orleans broke. The city was drowned. You had a bunch of economic Republican royalists in charge of the economy. We were getting absolutely killed. And then a guy stood up in Louisiana named Huey Long and said, we're going to have to kick the rich in the behind, and we're going to need a system of old age pension. We're going to need a system where schools are free for all kids, and the government better stop drowning us. And his program became the New Deal, and it changed America. But, you know, it seemed hopeless in 27, especially with the levees breaking in New Orleans. It just seemed like America's completely gone to hell. But, in fact, we were just, you know, beginning to get to wake people up. That's what it takes, and that's what you're doing, Peter.
Well, and certainly you and so many others as well, because if you start putting together Katrina and what happened in Virginia with the shootings, and it's really in, beginning to sap the spirit of many Americans, and it's necessary to not visit all of this just by yourself, because that's just the road to personal depression and disengagement, where the opposite is necessary. In fact, beginning with being armed with information. I mean, where Greg's book is Armed Madhouse, but we have to arm ourselves with information. We have to stop spending so much time with the MSM, the mainstream media, and start listening to other voices.
Well, yeah, I mean, the main thing here is that I'm going to give you the real story. And, in fact, it's so grim, it's funny. I mean, it's just darkly humorous. It's just like, you know, I mean, they arrested me. While I was doing the New Orleans investigation, I was charged by the Department of Homeland Security with violating the anti-terror laws. I was basically, you know, charged as a terrorist. You're lucky that I'm not, you know, in an orange suit calling you from Guantanamo. But what they were trying to do is really, and I got out of it because, see, what I was doing was I was filming what was happening in New Orleans, which is, and what they're doing in New Orleans, they're going to take it to Detroit soon enough. They had taken 73,000 survivors of Katrina and threw them into the swamps near Baton Rouge, right next to the Exxon refinery. It's called Cancer Alley. That's where we put the survivors of Katrina, in these airstreams, surrounded by barbed wire. And I'm filming this thing. And Homeland Security grabs me because these encampments which are like prison camps except without prison furloughs because there's no place to go home. You know, these encampments, I wanted to show them right next to the refinery. Say, oh, that's critical infrastructure. And, you know, we can't let you film that. Like Osama is going to, you know, look at the filthy smokestacks in my photos and figure, aha, there's our target. And as I finally pointed out to them, and it took a couple days, but that if Osama really wanted to target this critical infrastructure, all he had to do was go on Google Map. You know, but this is like the grim horror show, which is also slapstick comedy in America. I mean, it's so bad, it's funny, and I try to bring that out, because I think we're better off, as you say. I've been traveling around with comics like Janine Garofalo, you know, Greg Proops, and others, because otherwise, it's the only way to get it across. They cannot handle the ridicule.
Well, the book is amazing, both in its presentation, great art in it. In fact, there's also a DVD available. It's all from Greg Palast, Armed Madhouse, the name of the book now, in paperback from Baghdad to New Orleans, Sordid Secrets and Strange Tales of a White House Gone Wild. The paperback, a Plume book from Penguin. You go to penguin.com. Best of all, go to Greg Palast, PALAST.com, and you can find out all about how to order the book and how to get more involved. As usual, Greg Palast, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werbe Show.
Peter, you're the best.
This is WRIN.com.
My body started shaking and I can't take no more. We'll be right back.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Here's a story that I'm going to tell quickly before we introduce our guest. And it might, actually it goes right to the heart of what we're going to be talking about. Several years ago, my wife and I were visiting a farm, and we saw the son of the owner of the farm who was petting three calves. And he looked like he was petting like pets, these calves. And my wife said to him, do they have names? And suddenly he turned rather demonic and said, yeah, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. To the horror of my wife and I, who haven't eaten meat in quite a while. Joining me is Gene Bauer. He's the co-founder and president of Farm Sanctuary. It's America's leading farm animal protection organization. Gene Bauer has played an important role in passing the only laws existing in the U.S. that prohibit cruel farming methods, including the Florida ban on gestation crates, the Arizona ban on veal and gestation crates, and the California and Chicago bans on foie gras. If you don't know what foie gras is, Gene Bauer will tell us. Gene Bauer, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
It's great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
I just received your spring issue of Farm Sanctuary News. People can get a look at how to receive that by going to farmsanctuary.org. Gene Bauer, tell us some about Farm Sanctuary. You're the co-founder. Tell us the genesis of all this.
Yeah, well, I actually grew up in Los Angeles, so didn't have a whole lot of experience with farming or farm animals as I grew up. But I always, you know, wondered about food and where it came from and wondered about a lot of things. And I also grew up seeing lots of problems around me in the world. You know, there's wars, there's homelessness, there's hunger, there's cruelty. And, you know, wanted always to do something about it. So the more I learned, the more I came to see how profound our food choices are and how each time we buy something in the store and consume it, it affects ourselves, our own health, but also affects the earth and rural communities and animals and others. So by 1986, this was a pretty solid thought in my mind. And, you know, but not knowing much about farming, we felt it was important to actually go out and start seeing what was happening. And so we started visiting farms and stockyards and literally finding living animals thrown in trash cans or on piles of dead animals. And so we started bringing them home. And at the time...
Well, who's the we here? You mentioned this.
Me and my former wife.
Okay.
Whose name's Lori.
Okay.
And so we, you know, started bringing these animals to the place where we were living, which was a little row house in Wilmington, Delaware, and taking care of them and nursing them back to health. And we started, you know, doing this more often, and we ended up with calves and pigs and chickens and turkeys and sheep and goats. And it was clear we needed more space, so a farmer in Pennsylvania let us use his land, and then we eventually got this farm here in Watkinsville, New York, in 1989. We've been here since then, and we also now have a farm in Northern California, and we have members across the country. We work to stop cruelty and pass laws to prohibit certain inhumane farming practices. And we also encourage people to consider, you know, what they eat. And specifically, we encourage people to consider adopting a vegan lifestyle, you know, not eating any meat, dairy, or eggs. It's healthier for people. It's healthier for animals. It's healthier for the earth. It's good for everybody. And so that's something that we enthusiastically advocate.
Yeah, if there is a hard line against all consumption of animal products, a vegan diet, that's one thing. Explain to us, if you will, Gene Bauer, what where the line is between a cruel factory farm where then the animal is slaughtered and a nice humane grazing situation where the animals get petted and then wind up to be breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Well, you know, there is in farming... quite a variation of what happens. And, you know, the industrial farms are abominable. And I don't know of anybody who has seen these things and who thinks that they're good. And here you have animals in these small cages and crates where they can't walk or turn around or engage in natural behaviors. They suffer both physically and psychologically because of this intensive confinement. They're, you know, given lots of drugs to be kept alive. And they're slaughtered at very young ages. Now, there's a growing concern and awareness about this type of factory farming, and there's widespread opposition to it. And we're now starting to see some laws pass, and, you know, we're seeing consumers speaking out and demanding reforms and demanding that chefs and restaurants provide food that is produced in a way that is more consistent with societal values. What's happening, though, is that it's starting to be a little bit more complicated because some foods that are being sold as humane, you know, really are not humane. And so the consumer has to really be sort of mindful of labels and because a lot of times these labels are misleading. The term natural, for example, if somebody was to go buy natural beef, that could come from an animal who is still fed antibiotics and hormones.
Mm-hmm.
So that doesn't really comport with what most people would assume natural means. So although there is starting to be a move away from the cruelest forms of industrialized farming now, there are still questions about what is appropriate and what, you know, just how well the animals are being cared for. And, of course, at the end of the day, you know, if they're slaughtered for meat, that is an inherently violent act. And so we do promote a vegan lifestyle. We do that enthusiastically. We work also intensely to stop industrialized cruelty. But when it comes to what most people eat, you know, obviously each of us needs to make our own food choices. And we just encourage people to get as close to that vegan side and hopefully over that vegan line if they can.
Well, I suspect two things are present. One, if people had to slaughter at this point in our history as a species, us, the humans, had to slaughter and process our own meat products, there probably would be an astronomical rise in vegetarians and vegans. But the other aspect of it, I think if they're given the consumption of meat products, if there wasn't factory farming, they could not make available enough meat products, given how much, like for instance, cows. I forgot what the figures are about what it takes in terms of wheat and corn feed and all that to raise one. That it almost that the level of consumption of animal products almost requires factory production of animals.
It, absolutely, absolutely. Raising meat is very inefficient. It takes something like 10 to 20 pounds of feed to produce 1 pound of animal protein. And so, you know, you have to grow this feed, and it's oftentimes monocrop corn or soybeans that is grown in these massive fields, oftentimes with USDA subsidies, you know. So, you know, the irony of this whole thing is that we are told in this country that our food is cheap, that we only spend 10 cents on every dollar for food. And, you know, in a very superficial way, that may be true, but we also spend money in taxes to subsidize the feed for farm animals. We farming operations are also exempted from property taxes and other taxes, so they have those kinds of benefits. We also spend a lot of money, something like 20 cents on every dollar, on health care. And one of the reasons we have such, you know, poor health in this country is because of the way we eat. We eat far too many animal products. So there's numerous costs associated with industrial farming, industrial animal production, that are not really accounted for. And if these animals were treated in a better way, if the real costs of our meat, dairy, and egg consumption were accounted for, there would be a lot less of those products consumed.
Gene Bauer is my guest on the Peter Werby Show. He's the co-founder and president of Farm Sanctuary, and you can go to farmsanctuary.org for more information how to join, more information how to get their newsletter, Farm Sanctuary News. Actually, newsletter doesn't describe it properly. It's a glossy magazine with lots of interesting articles in it. Now, I suspect a lot of listeners, probably the vast majority of who consume animal products, probably think, well, hey, isn't there anything I can do in the world that isn't going to have some negative aspect to it? And that I consider, and I'm not myself, I'm opposing this, I consider like a hamburger or pork roast or chicken wings or whatever as part of the same category is lettuce and corn and what have you. In other words, it's food stuff. Animals are food machines that are created by human beings for the function of consuming them. It's not, I mean, it's another thing. We start talking about wild animals and what have you, old Ted Nugent, kill 'em and grill 'em. Well, never mind. Don't get me started on him. But the idea is let me, another example. I heard one time an interview with a South Korean who ran a restaurant where they served dog. And he said, "Don't worry, we don't serve pet dog, we serve food dog." Well, you and I and any American listening probably going, "Oh." But there is this, I guess, ethical distinction, and that's what I was getting at earlier. So, or does Farm Sanctuary just want to now concentrate on the worst abuses inherent in factory farm production?
Well, you know, I would just sort of, you know, raise the question about, you know, ethical distinction. What is the ethical distinction between, you know, say, food dog and companion or friend dog? And, you know, here at the farm, we have animals who are our friends. We have cows, pigs, chickens, and they are not food animals to us. And so I think there is this assumption that we have that that's what they're for. But we are asking people to question that assumption and to recognize that these are living creatures, and we don't need to kill and eat them. In fact, we can be healthy not doing so. So that's what we encourage on the consumer side and on the education side, and we... And what people can do is, you know, maybe one day a week not eat meat or eat less meat, or, you know, those are the kinds of consumer things people can do. On the legislative front, what we're doing is we're trying to ban some of the cruelest practices, such as the veal crate, where calves are taken from their mothers immediately at birth, chained by the neck in a 2-foot-wide crate, and that's how they live their whole lives. We think that that is inhumane and outside the bounds of acceptable conduct in our society. So we're trying to ban those cruelties.
Well, I also mentioned that foie gras, which people might not be familiar with as well. It's spelled F-O-I-E-G-R-A-S. And if you would, Gene Bauer, describe that. And it's quite a delicacy among the wealthy because it's very expensive. And yet it's got this dark side.
Oh, absolutely. Foie gras is French, and it literally means fatty liver. And it's produced by taking a pipe and shoving it down the throats of ducks or geese and force-feeding them enormous quantities of food, up to one-third of their body weight a day. And this causes their livers to expand 10 times the normal size. And it is that enlarged fatty liver that is then sold as foie gras. And the liver at a certain point becomes dysfunctional. It actually becomes diseased. And the birds would die of this if they were not killed at a young age, so their livers could be taken and sold as foie gras.
Well, sometimes I've told people that, and they say, "Oh, I like veal parmesan," or "I like foie gras." And so I go, "Well, I mean, I don't know what you can say once you've told them the practice, and then they still are going to put it in the category of acceptable ingestion." And people make those distinctions. Obviously, we're not going to eat food dog. Most of us are not going to eat horse. Although years ago, it was, I think during World War II, it was consumed. So the what is consumable is sort of shifting. So Farm Sanctuary intervenes in that process to, as you said, educate.
Absolutely. And to ask people to ask themselves questions and to question some of their assumptions. You know, usually most of us grow up eating meat, milk, and eggs. In fact, you know, I grew up in Los Angeles, and when I was younger, I actually, you know, I grew up in Hollywood and would do commercials for places like McDonald's and Kentucky Fried Chicken, I'm now embarrassed to say. So we grow up with certain habits, and changing is difficult. And I think a lot of people just quickly put up a wall and dismiss the idea of changing. We want to encourage people and frankly empower people to change in a way that is good for them. It's good for their health. It is good, I think, for their conscience to be eating in a way that is consistent with their own values. You know, as you mentioned before, you know, if people had to kill animals and eat them themselves, you know, a lot more people would be vegetarian. So, you know, we're encouraging people to live in a way that is humane and to eat in a way that is consistent with their best ideals.
Well, I have to say, I mean, oftentimes people are critical of hunters, but they are right in there. They see what they've killed. They, you know, they put their hands, you know, when they're dressing it, they're right in there. I guess my little ethical. In fact, I came to a mostly vegetarian diet through health interest and have expanded it ethically to the point where now I say I will eat only what I would be willing to kill. And for better or for worse, I'm willing to fish. But as you said, there are some choices. Although with fish consumption, there are, and we won't even, let's stay on land here with Farm Sanctuary, but there are some real concerns about commercial fish as well. But Gene Bauer, tell us, though, you've made some real inroads. You've been instrumental, you and Farm Sanctuary, in passing legislation in a number of different locales. But in your spring 2007 Farm Sanctuary News magazine, you asked the question, industry, small steps, publicity stunts, or progress? And what do you answer in the magazine?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a complicated thing. We in 2006, we were part of an initiative in the state of Arizona to ban the use of veal crates, which, you know, confine young calves for their lives in 2-foot-wide crates, and gestation crates, which is how breeding pigs are kept, 2-foot-wide crates for years at a time. And so we passed that measure to ban those practices in Arizona. And afterwards, Smithfield, which is the world's largest pork producer, and Strauss Veal, which is the largest veal producer in North America, both announced that they would stop using crates, these 2-foot-wide enclosures, and go to group housing. Now, that is a positive step in that the animals will have a little bit more space, and also in that it indicates that industry is now starting to respond to consumers' concerns. However, it is likely that in both cases with Strauss Veal and also with Smithfield, they will still not allow the animals to have very much space. They will not likely let them go out and graze if they're calves or root in the soil if they're pigs. The animals will most likely still just be kept in pens with concrete floors and metal bars around them. So it is a step away from the cruelest confinement, but it's still a long way from ideal.
Well, tell us a little about the idea of sentient beings, for ones that can think and feel and respond to their circumstances. I raised earlier the idea of commercially produced meat as being thought of as mainly no different than a crop being raised, and essentially it's there for humans to eat. When you and tell us maybe in answering a little about the actual rescue, do you get the sense that a pig will be unhappy, crated, and joyful when they're at Farm Sanctuary?
Oh, absolutely. Just like cats or dogs, cows and pigs and chickens and other farm animals learn about their surroundings. They respond to how they're treated. Animals, when they first come in here, are often very fearful because they've been treated so badly their whole lives. But over time, they warm up. They learn to trust people again and recognize that they're in a safe place. One of our first visitors here to Farm Sanctuary in Watkins Glen, New York, was a pig farmer. And he had confined his animals in small areas and didn't treat them very well. Like most farmers who see them as meat don't tend to treat them very well. And he came to our farm, and he saw a couple of our interns, young women, maybe around in their 20s, slight, you know, thin, maybe weighed 100 pounds each, in this barn with these 500-pound pigs. And this farmer came in, and he was shocked. He said, "Man, you better watch yourself. Those pigs are dangerous. One will attack you, and then the other will have your guts in a second." That's actually what he said.
Huh.
And then he went on to describe how violent, in his opinion, these sows are, how he had a sow, and she had babies, and he took the babies away, and she came after him. And he didn't even recognize that this action that he, you know, taking her babies, caused her to respond. So animals, you know, just like humans, will respond to kindness, with kindness in most cases. And so, you know, that's what we've learned here. And, you know, over the years, human beings have tended to want to separate ourselves from other animals. Just like, you know, within our own species, we've separated male from female or one race from another race. In fact, animals and are much more like us than we have up until recently acknowledged. We used to say, for example, and rationalize that, well, humans are the tool-using animal. And then then Jane Goodall saw that chimpanzees were using tools, so we couldn't say that anymore. Then humans are the only animals that use language. But now we're seeing that other animals communicate through different forms of language. And so we're recognizing that other animals have a sentience, an intelligence, and abilities and feelings that are pretty similar to ours. And it's causing us now to think about some fundamental questions, and I think it's a good thing. And I think that when we recognize that other animals are really not that different from us, and when we cause harm to other animals, we're not only causing them harm, but I think we are cutting off sort of the best of our own humanity. We're causing ourselves to be callous and lacking in empathy. And I think that, you know, empathy is a very important human quality.
Now, if we leave corporate farming, and which wants to turn the whole world, I mean, as just by its definition, but everything appears as a commodity in this society. But the small farmers, like your pig farmer who visited Farm Sanctuary, he has a business, and I'm sure he took the babies away, not because he was a cruel man inherently, but probably he was selling these like for Christmas as suckling pigs that some people think of as a delicacy. And we go into rural areas. In fact, this program is heard all over the country and all over the world to people that raise animals for market. You may be saying, hey, or they may be saying, hey, Gene Bauer, you're cutting off my source of income.
You know, I can understand why people would feel that way. And it becomes a very emotional issue, understandably, if people feel that we're saying that we're cutting off their income. But, you know, when I talk to farmers and they say, well, what do you want me to do? You know, I would tend to respond by saying, well, you know, if I had 100 acres or 50 acres or whatever it was, you know, I would start moving into the direction of producing something else, like maybe apple trees, or, you know, in different parts of the country, different crops will grow. And there's a growing market now for locally produced fruits and vegetables and other plant products. So there's, I think, enormous opportunities, and it's just a matter of taking advantage of them.
Yeah, raise bees before they all disappear.
I mean, what we've done to this planet and our sort of industrialized monocrop agricultural approach with animals and also with plants, you know, corn and things like that, is devastating to bees and wild plants, wild animals, and wild ecosystems. I think we've now recognized that we have to do things differently.
Just a minute left, Gene Bauer. Tell us, Farm Sanctuary, I mean, there are so many mistreated farm animals. How do you keep up on your properties with taking these animals in?
We take in as many animals as we can, but the fact is that we're never going to be able to rescue them all. So we also work to advocate for changes, you know, to change laws, and also encourage individual citizens to take responsibility for their food choices and to hopefully make choices that are humane and are consistent with their own ideals. Because up until recently, a lot of people have not thought aloud about their food, but I think that's thankfully starting to change.
And Farm Sanctuary is a membership organization, am I correct?
That's right. We would love for people to join Farm Sanctuary, and we have a website that, you know, farmsanctuary.org. And you become a member and you receive our magazine four times a year and other updates about what's happening.
And you have a presence here in Michigan?
We do. Every fall we do a walkathon in Ann Arbor, one of our longest standing Walk for Farm Animals in the U.S.
And I mean, this is a fundraiser in the sense that the walks are for different benefits.
That's correct. It's a fundraiser and also an awareness raiser.
Well, please tell these folks that they can probably get some public service announcements out of me on these stations because, like so many others that we promote here, I'd be glad to do that as well. Well, I want to thank you so much for being with me. My guest has been Gene Bauer. He's a co-founder and president of Farm Sanctuary. It's America's leading farm animal protection organization. If you're curious about this and anything from the impact of factory farming to the idea of switching to a vegetarian vegetarian or vegan diet. The information is all there at farmsanctuary.org. I'll also have a link on my site, peterwerby.com. Gene Bauer, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
This is WRIM.com.
and VH1 want to send you to the second annual VH1 Rock Honors. Live at the Mandalay Bay in Las Vegas, Saturday, May 12th. Ozzy Osbourne, Hearts, Genesis, and ZZ Top. All performing live on one stage for one night only. Want to jet out to Sin City courtesy of VH1 and the rest? Keep it locked at 101 WRIF for your chance to win a Gibson Epiphone SG Special Electric Guitar. Performance is their passion. One lucky riff winner and a guest will be off to Vegas to witness history in the making. The VH1 Rock Hunters. Complete with airfare, hotel accommodations, tickets to the show, and $100 Mandalay Bay Bucks. The VH1 Rock Hunters. Live Saturday, May 12th. Let there be rock. Only from VH1 and 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
Hey, kids. We're ready to go on the air from one end of the camp to the other.
Oh, my gosh.
Pick up that mic and announce the first tune.
101 FM, WRIF Detroit. Slayer, Alan Beck stepping in following Peter Werby and Julian Jordan tonight. Following Night Call here on the Riff. I'm here till 5:30 a.m. when Mark and Mike take over for Drew and Mike in the morning. Of course, the guys.